The following is a presentation of the Six Arrows Radio Network.
Today on the Workbench, it's the Holiday Shopping Show. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Workbench. I'm your host, George, KJ6VU.
And I'm Jeremy, KF7IJZ.
This episode of the Workbench is brought to you by Elecraft, makers of high-performance radios, amplifiers, and other great station accessories. Check them out at www.elecraft.com. And by Autodesk, the makers of Eagle PCB design tools, the software we use to design all of our Workbench build projects. For more info and your free copy of Eagle, go to www.autodesk.com/eagle today. Before we start the show, recently we announced the winner of the 30-watt PowerFilm solar panel. So far, our friends at PowerFilm have not been able to contact that winner, so we're going to draw a new winner. Here is Seth Hansen from PowerFilm to announce the new winner. Seth, welcome back to the Workbench Podcast.
Thank you. Good to be back.
And the last time we talked about the 30-watt PowerFilm solar panel giveaway, we had a winner, and that winner is Jim. And as of now, Jim has not responded.
Yeah, unfortunately, we didn't hear from him inside of a time window that we stated, so we have another winner.
Yeah, it's too bad for Jim. Sorry that that didn't work out, but who's the new lucky winner?
The winner is David Homan. David, I'll reach out to you via email as well with the email that you opted in with. But congratulations. Once I get into contact with you, we can get you that panel as soon as possible.
Okay, David, so you really need to respond because you don't want to be in the same boat that poor Jim was in.
Yeah, hopefully. And then another little piece of news, but I'm going to extend this promotion that we talked about last time, 10% off of this item until Christmas. So, we just wanted to open it up and keep it open as long as possible for people to buy the panel for themselves as a gift, whatever they see fit.
Oh, that's great. So why don't you tell us one more time exactly what that product is?
Absolutely. So it's the 30-watt foldable, and it is includes an Anderson PowerPole connector, because we understand that Anderson PowerPole is nearly ubiquitous amongst the ham community. And our panels feature a Delphi WeatherPak, which is a great connector, but it actually is an automotive connector. We use it because it's watertight, but Anderson PowerPole makes more sense for ham radio operators. So it will come with that cable. And the claim code, again, is ham radio, one word, capital H, capital R. And you can save 10% off of that item. It's fulfilled through Amazon.
How would they find the product?
Yeah, the easiest way is to go to our website. It's www.powerfilmsolar.com/products/workbench. And so you'll just see a link there you can click, and the item is on Amazon, so fulfillment will be through Amazon.
And how long is that special deal going to be available to listeners?
Yeah, so that's going until Christmas Day. We wanted to leave it as open as long as possible, so people will have more than enough time, if they so choose, to visit and make that purchase.
So on the last show, I mentioned that I thought that the 30-watt panel would be like the perfect stocking stuffer for Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the sweet spot for us. It's a very lightweight panel. It's about a pound and a half, so very lightweight. But it's getting up there in the wattage area where you can do some serious charging. So you can obviously power a small QRP rig. You can direct charge cell phones very quickly with the proper adapters. But yeah, I mean, once you get 30 watts and above, that's a decent amount of power that you can use, but in a very lightweight package.
And with that panel, if you had good sun, What's the voltage and the current max that you could expect to get out of that?
I believe it is 1.8 amps, and that is in full sun. No, absolutely. Yeah, it adds very minimal weight to your pack, to your setup, and that's huge depending on where you are. So yeah, I think it's a wonderful panel. It's a good kind of introduction into our technology. So I hope some of your listeners take advantage.
Well, hey, thanks so much. We really appreciate you doing that for our listeners, and I'm sure they appreciate it too.
Thank you, George.
Elecraft is one of my top picks for high-performance HF radios. They make fantastic base station-style radios, amplifiers, pan adapters, and other station accessories. They're also the designers of the KX3 and KX2, the ultimate portable HF radios. If you're thinking about SOTA, portable operating, or travel, you really need to be looking at Elecraft. Elecraft has some of the best designs in the industry, compact, high-performance, feature-rich designs. You're really going to love them. The KX2 is my personal favorite for going portable. It's ultra-small, 80 through 10 meters, sideband CW and data modes, and the thing runs 10 watts on the internal batteries. You'll love it. Check it out at elecraft.com.
Welcome once again to the Ham Radio 360 Workbench Podcast, your bi-weekly deep dive into making topics of interest to the radio amateur. This week, George, it's that time of year again.
What time of year is that, Jeremy?
The time when we help all of our listeners find every excess dollar in their house and help them get rid of it.
You mean we get to spend other people's money?
Yes, we get to spend other people's money. Welcome to our annual holiday shopping show. And tonight we are joined by a lot of fantastic guests from previous episodes.
So tell us who's here tonight.
First of all, we have Smitty, KR6ZY. Smitty, how you doing?
Hey, everybody. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Well, thanks for agreeing to come back on. Joined for the first time on the workbench, but not his first Ham Radio 360 appearance, we have Nick Kartsoukas.
Close enough.
KN6NK, also known online as Exploding Lemur.
Hello. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Awesome. And then finally, all the way from our folks, our neighbors to the north, is Rod Hardman, VA3ON. Rod, how are you this evening?
Greetings from the Great White North, although I'm feeling a little out of place because I think I should have a pseudonym, judging from the other guests, but that's okay.
So let's give him one. What would a good pseudonym be?
Oh, no. Here Rod? We go.
I see no way this can end poorly.
Yeah, let's move on.
All right. We'll work on that.
Well, this week, folks, everybody has cleared off their workbenches to make room for large rolls of paper and writing implements as we are working on our holiday wish lists. And today we're going to do something a little bit different. We are going to jump right in to the content of the show.
And one thing we thought about when we were putting this together is there's a lot of podcasts that are very radio-centric, right? So, well, what handy-talky would you pick this year kind of a thing? But, of course, we're not going to do that because everybody else is doing that. So we decided to focus on topics which are of particular interest to the DIY crowd that listen to this podcast. So we're going to focus more on things like tools and test equipment and kits and other kind of cool stocking stuffers that are more DIY-focused.
I suspect there might be an awful lot of, yeah, he already suggested the thing I was going to say. So, I think we've got a lot of really good, unique stuff in here as well. But don't be surprised if you hear a particular item or suggestion repeated multiple times. You just kind of take that as a plus one in the how useful this kind of thing really is.
So I've already seen some dupes on the list. So, Rod, a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago or so, we were exchanging an email about our favorite soda gear. And I think when we exchanged the list of what each of us would pack on a soda expedition, I noticed that the list of stuff was like 80% was the same exact stuff, right down to the multi-tool.
Yes, and Canadians, we call that consensus building. It's a good thing.
Well, we definitely build a consensus about what to put in your backpack. So that was pretty cool. So I noticed there are a few things, a few dupes, but that's okay. One thing I also want to mention is that one of the reasons why you three guys are on the show is because you, like, of course, a lot of our listeners, but you guys are very hands-on and build a lot of projects. And we thought it would be great to diversify the input and not just get the list of what Jeremy and I want, but to kind of expand that thinking a little bit and see what everybody else is interested in.
So I think this is a great idea. Furthermore, I want to encourage you all to get my wife to listen to this show, and then I will reciprocate and encourage your wives, partners, whoever's to go listen to this show as well. And because if I tell my wife to listen, she's like, yeah, no. But, you know, if somebody else does it, that might work. I think we're onto something.
Although she might discover what we bought already.
Ooh, that would be tragic.
Yeah. I don't need one of those. I bought two, you know, over the summer.
It's good to have a spare.
The thought bubble is, now I have a spare. Yeah.
Well, I was more, yeah, I'm more referring to the outing ourselves as having already spent the money.
Exactly. Yeah,
It's unfortunate we didn't do this as a spreadsheet. We could have just summed all of the price values just to see what happened.
Nope.
There are some things you should never do. Never.
That is among them.
I mean, unless you're building a list for insurance.
Just remember that this is all cheaper than owning an airplane.
Oh, very good point.
That's a very good point. I have built a workbench hewn from marble excavated from some site in Rome.
Gold. Mighty fine soldering surface, right?
Gold, yes.
You're not going to burn that.
Gold filigree.
Is the gold grounded to keep it ESD safe?
Oh, of course.
Of course.
Although it's the high conductivity marble.
So let's get this party started, shall we?
All right. Hey, let's start with, I don't know. How about tools?
I guess I can go. So workbench gear tools. Let's see here. I was looking at the list, and a lot of you listed a lot of very good things. The one thing that I didn't see listed anywhere else that I want to make sure gets covered is a good way of holding your projects. I have a Panavice Junior, which is a little thing that you can either just set on top of your desk, or you can actually bolt it down to the desk if you don't want it to move around. And it's a little clamper thing. It's not spring loaded. It's on a screw drive. So you can kind of, you know, stick your circuit board into this thing, and it's got these big arms that that go in and hold it from the sides and allow you to, you know, it holds the circuit board while you're actually going in and soldering things. So it's not sitting on the table where you're at risk of like soldering onto your Formica countertop or whatever, but it holds your boards in good place. And I think they're relatively inexpensive. I think they're about $50 ish, somewhere around there. And very useful. I use it on pretty much every project that I can. That is to say, I have a very few boards that are too big for it, but it's a great little device. And I wanted to make sure it got put on the list.
So how
now, they make different models. What you said, the which one, the Mini?
Junior.
I don't know if I've ever seen a Junior. What is so Junior about it? Is it just smaller than the normal one?
I don't know. Oh, $27 on Amazon right now.
Less than 30. The jaws that it has, I mean, so the base is like the standard heavy duty aluminum. But the jaws and the pivot head are all made out of like a high durability plastic. And there are a couple of channels cut in the jaws for being able to securely hold things like boards. And I agree, this is a fantastic tool. I very much love mine. In fact, last year when we talked about this, I even upgraded mine with this base that had like all of these different like helping hands that can help hold stuff while you use it.
Oh, like the plastic kind of octopusy ones?
Yes. Yeah. I forget the name of the company. And honestly, I probably should have looked that up. But in hindsight, it was a fantastic idea. It was a gift from my wife and I love it. But I find that more often than not, when I'm using the Panavice Junior on its own. So like last year, it was a great idea, but I would not call it a must buy.
The octopus arm thing.
Yeah, the forearm with the nice, beautiful milled plate that it all attaches to.
Yeah.
Hobby River, I think, was the company Hobby Creek, that's it. Hobby Creek is the one that made it.
Yeah.
So for my Panavice, I use the big round base that has little
pockets so you can put little components in it, which of course I don't never use to put components. It's just debris lands in there. But the edge of the of that base, that well, that base makes the vise not tip over. So that's it makes it more stable. But on the edge of that plate, there are three holes that are tapped with quarter 20 threading. And what I do is get about a 2.5 inch long quarter 20 bolt, screw it into one of those holes, and I use that for my solder spool. And it's kind of the poor man's solder spool, and it works great.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah, I've been doing that forever, and it just works really fine. And I, you know, there are some things that you'll buy for your bench, you'll buy and you will keep for your whole life. And a pan of ice is one of those things.
It's one of them, yeah.
So I have a complimentary product because the junior, I think the jaw is only open to about what, like 4.5 inches, 5 inches, something like that.
It's not huge. Yeah.
So there is there's a company called Avon, Alpha Victor Echo November, and they make this little contraption that is a pair of like blue columns on an aluminum bar with some rubber feet.
Yeah.
And this thing is also designed for holding circuit boards. And the two things that actually hold the boards are not attached at all. But you basically adjust this thing as wide or as narrow as you need it to hold a board, and you bring it together and then like kind of crank it down to keep it from moving. And it can accommodate boards up to like almost 8 inches. So it says 198 millimeters. So that's 7.8 inches. But it is also a good value at under $12.
Yeah, I've got one of these, and it's one of the cool things I like about it is if you're doing through-hole stuff, the little grips are really easy to rotate, so you can place your components, flip the board, solder, flip it back, and it's really easy to do that.
Yeah,
I think this is where we're going to have to start calling out, got it, need it. Because I've got the exact same thing, and this is getting a little spooky. We're back into that land again, George.
Yeah, but see, the good news is that for practical advice for the listeners, they don't have to sit here and think, I don't know which one to pick. It's going to be the one that we recommend. Yep. So I'm going to throw out one more PCB vise thing that is no longer manufactured. So I'm sad to say, but there's a very famous guy named Doug Hendricks, who's a QRP a guy.
Legend. Yeah.
And Doug has made all kinds of QRP kits over the years, and he made a PCB vise, and I bought one. I forgot how much it was, like $10. It was a couple pieces of aluminum, nicely anodized, and the head that attaches to the PC board was just a piece of like half-inch square stock aluminum with a slot and two nylon screws. So the only grippy part was like these two nylon screws in this piece about an inch long, and it would swivel. And this was like the most convenient tool to hold a circuit board while you're working on it because it's very small. And so I wanted to buy a spare, and they don't make them anymore. And I contacted Doug, and I said, you know, whatever happened to those vices? He said, well, you know, they got kind of expensive to make, so we stopped making them. This little vise is awesome. And if you want to see a picture of it, actually, I think Doug sold his business to a company called Pacific Antenna. And it's that item is no longer on the website. But if you do a Google search, you'll find it. And it's like a red anodized little jig. So,
okay.
Yeah, we'll have to come back to this topic offline. That's cool.
Cool. All right. So moving on. Nick.
So.
Well, no, we're going to round robin it. I didn't figure we'd let everybody dump their entire list.
No, no, I'm quiet. Go.
No, hold on. Smitty, what else?
No, it wasn't me. I chuckled because I think Rod was trying to say something.
Oh,
I was jumping in there.
Well, go ahead, Rod.
I was being rude. I'm sorry.
That's so unlike you.
So let me just jump in here. So what we've got, I started looking through one of my oldest toolkits, and I think all of us at one point or another have had one of these awful sets of jeweler screwdrivers that come in the blue plastic base with a clear top, and they feel awful, and they're just the worst things ever. So what I realized is years ago, I bought this Wiha, W-I-H-A, I think. It is a set of screwdrivers. They're German. They're persnickety. They're absolutely wonderful things, W-I-H-A. System for Precision Modular Screwdrivers. And can you imagine saying that with a nice German accent? Well, it's exactly what you want to go for. I put a link in the show notes for it. What they are is modular steel sections about 4 inches long, bit on either end. They have Torx. They have very fine slot and Phillips. They do not have Robertson, which makes me as a Canadian very sad, but it's probably the only thing they don't have. But these are wonderful tools. I've had them for 25 years, and there's nary a scratch on them. They're wonderful things. You can find them in most high-end electronic stores.
Give us the name again.
W-I-H-A, WIHA, System for Precision Modular Screwdrivers. And they're about the size, they're a little beefier than those awful things that we find in the blue case. And they also, you can get a version of them that's anti-static and all this other good stuff. That'll nice. Combine with one other German pick. These are completely unpronounceable. The Knipex. Yes, I'll spell that. K-N-I-P-E-X. Mini pliers. And they come in sets of two. And I put, again, the part number in the show notes. But what got was interesting about this set of pliers was, one, they're kind of small. They're only about 5 inches. But they're perfect for connectors, for those awful connectors that get just jammed in. But the thing I really like about these, aside from the fact that they've got an absolutely buttery mechanism on them, is that one of the sets is perfectly parallel. So when you go to open and close these things, I don't know if you've ever had these connectors that have two slotted sides where you have to try to figure out how to not maul them while you're bringing the connectors in and out. Well, they're absolutely perfect for that. So those are my German tool picks for the day.
Nice.
So while we're talking about WIHA, I have two pairs of WIHA tweezers that I use for surface mount work. And they are just amazing. They are incredibly sharp and strong and just really easy to use for picking up surface mount components and placing them. The downside is they're about $25 each. They're Holy definitely cats. Not, yeah, they're definitely not cheap, but they are so nice. There are alternatives. There are sets out there that have multiple tweezers for about $9. But having used both, you can tell the difference.
There is a difference, yeah.
Yep. So if you do a lot of surface mount, I would definitely look at investing in some really good tweezers. And also what has helped me with surface mount stuff is a stereo microscope that I got off Amazon. What was the brand? It's Amscope. They're about $190, which is not cheap, certainly, but for a stereo microscope, that's a really good price.
Yeah, that's a really good price. Now, what's funny is that you had posted about this earlier this week, because somebody else had recommended this on Twitter. And of course, I asked you why a stereo microscope versus some type of digital imager that outputs to a screen, and you had a very good answer for that.
Yeah, so I have used a USB microscope before to try and do surface mount, and I found there was just way too much latency between any movement I made and when it was being displayed on the screen. It was such that I really couldn't do it for soldering. It didn't give me the feedback I needed fast enough.
Gotcha.
And it's also not stereo, right?
Yeah, you also lose out on depth perception.
Depth perception.
And I have, I wear glasses and my eyes are funky and I have astigmatism, but the eyepieces on these AMScopes are adjustable. So I can take my glasses off, peer through, and I can get it adjusted pretty good.
So how much like room to work do you have between the stage and the final objective lens?
It is about, I'd say about 8 inches.
Oh, wow. That's a lot of room.
Yeah. That's a good amount of space.
Well, one of the things that I was going to recommend in this, in the theme of vision enhancement is one of those inexpensive USB microscopes. I had originally seen these at, it might have been at Shelby. The Quicksilver radio guy was selling these things. But basically, it is a high magnification USB microscope that has a built-in LED ring light. The one that I wound up with is by a brand that that I know and trust from a lot of their USB and USB charging accessories. It's a company called Pluggable, Pluggable. And they offer a 2 megapixel, which at first I was freaked out. I was like, oh, that's low. But it's a 2 megapixel USB scope with a built-in adjustable intensity LED light. The thing sells for $35. It comes with a little suction cup mount, so you can mount it to this little plastic base they give you or directly to your workbench or whatnot. Nowhere near as nice as the stereo microscope because you can raise the thing up, but you still certainly have nowhere near 8 inches of working space. This is probably more useful for aiding you in inspection versus trying to solder with it. Although I have used it, to try to tack a tiny wire onto a tiny pad, and it worked more or less. And it certainly was better than my own eyes or even the 5X desk magnifier that I have could do. Plus, it's also a lot of fun if you have kids to go find stuff and just look at it, really teeny tiny stuff under huge magnification plugged into a large monitor. So, yeah, the Pluggable USB microscope.
Some of those USB microscopes that I've seen also have either software or a button that you can press to take a snapshot of the screen, right?
Yeah, and so I'm glad you brought that up. Almost all of these have a host application that basically is what outputs the live view to your computer. And then most of them will pay attention. Then when you press that button, it will actually take a snapshot. But the fact of the matter is, at such high magnification, you touching the thing at all just makes it jiggle. And the imaging sensor on this is not a high refresh rate. So like the jello effect that was very prevalent on old original cell phone cameras is alive and well on these. So if I want to take a snapshot, you can also press a button in the software.
So I've got a little trick for using those microscopes, the USB ones. So that tiny little base it comes with, I found that with mine, I have one and tried using it, but that base really got in the way for me. So, you know those cantilever arm lamps that like you clamp to the side of your table?
Oh, yes.
I got one of those, threw the lamp away, and I have the microscope bolted to the end of it so I can just kind of bring it around and set it at the right spot on the table above where I'm working, and then I have clear space all around it to do whatever I need to do.
Well, that's a cool idea.
I want to plus one the idea of using those cantilever arms. I've got three of them in my office right now. In fact, the microphone I'm talking into is mounted to one. It was a $10 IKEA lamp. Took the lamp off, threw it away, like Nick said, and then jerry-rigged in the right bolt. I don't think was it 1224. I don't remember exactly that connects into the microphone. I've got another one that's hooked up to a webcam over my workbench. For when I actually get around to starting up Smitty working on something again, I want to be able to stream me working on the actual workbench instead of just at the computer. And then I've got a third one. I guess I didn't jerry-rig that one, but it's a third one that has the kind of the ring light around a large magnifying glass that you can kind of grab and pull down in front of the circuit board you're looking at to kind of do some inspection on that one without actually having to move the circuit board. But yeah, those little cheap $10 desk lamps make great arms for just about anything you want to put on them.
Cool.
And a slight modification to that as well, because I'm doing the exact same thing. So here we are again with the got it, need it. Where you can use grommets that you can actually drill into the surface of your desk and drop the base into there rather than having to deal with those awful clamps on the outside of the articulated arms.
I did that with my workbench for the light. Yeah, I gave up on trying to make a clamp work, so I just put a hole in the workbench.
Exactly.
Brilliant. Dropped
the end into it.
Yeah, that's actually exactly the mic boom that I'm using to talk on right now. That's what I did, is there's a hole through the workbench, and it's just stuck in there, and we're good to go.
So I'm still using the base that came with the clamp, but it's got four holes in it for screws. So the screws for the base of the lamp are screwed into, or the base for the lamp is screwed into my workbench. And so, yeah, it didn't actually drill a hole for the cantilever arm to go into, but the base that the cantilever arm goes into is screwed to the bench.
So what else have we got for hand tools?
I have something that is kind of an oddball item that I totally love, and it's a very specialized little gadget. And this would make a great stocking stuffer, by the way. That is a Weller ML100 Magnelite Micro Torch. I don't know if you've ever seen one of these things before, but it's about the size of a lighter. It looks kind of like a lighter. It's a plastic cylinder, and it's got a button on the side, and you squirt butane into it, and you click the button, and the little top pops open, and you would think it would be a flame just like a lighter, but instead it's like a jet. So this kind of conical jet shoots out the top about an inch, and it's a teeny weeny torch. And you might say, well, why do you need a little pocket torch? And the answer is, if you ever need to do a quick like heat shrink tubing application and you don't have a heat gun, or this is a field day specialty. If you need any concentrated heat, this little guy does just a fabulous job. And in fact, in a real pinch, if you don't have a soldering iron and you need to, let's say, just solder some wires together for an antenna, it would be perfectly fine to heat up the work and then apply the solder.
And on field day, it makes a wicked creme brulee.
Exactly.
On the subject, when I saw that link in the show notes, I got excited that you might have a recommendation for a butane soldering iron, and I clicked it on it and saw what it was. But it got me thinking that a butane soldering iron is something that I have wished I had for quite a while now. When I'm up on the roof dealing with an antenna and I want to either resolder or clean up or whatever, I don't want to trek my 100-foot extension cord and bring my Metcal up on the roof. And sometimes taking the antenna down from the roof is a pain in the butt as well. So,
That's a really good point. I have a butane soldering iron in my field day kit. So if that fails, then I have the torch. But butane soldering iron, the Weller branded ones are pretty good. And you can get a decent one for, I think it was about $50. I don't think it was, I'm just looking around here. They have them, looks like anything from about $40 to $150, depending on how professional you want one. But they work surprisingly well. I was a little leery about it, but I think they work pretty well. The good quality ones do.
Yeah.
There are also USB powered and rechargeable soldering irons that I've read reviews on recently that seem to be pretty decent. And if you're not interested in having, a torch flame going in your hand, those would be a good alternative.
Well, I'm going to ask you folks to put some links in the show notes for some of these things that you're referring to. Although, speaking of soldering, I want to take a poll real quick. So the question is, Hakko or Weller? Let's go around the group. Rod?
Weller.
George?
Hands down.
Weller.
Okay. Smitty?
Metcal.
Metcal's not an option.
Yes, it is. And it's going to be, it's one of the things I've listed here, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. I'm going to stand by it. Metcal.
All right, Nick.
So I have a Weller, but I would consider either one a good buy.
Okay. I'm Hakko.
Yeah, actually, I've never had a Hakko iron. So, I've seen them before. They look nice. I think either one is fine. You really can't complain.
Well, that's the point.
Let me actually answer your question directly. I grew up on Wellers because it's what I had at the time. They were great soldering irons. Having said that, I've been running a hardware hacking village for this thing at work that I do. And we have 12 Hakko 888s, and they're perfectly fine soldering irons. I would not recommend anyone to not buy one.
I mean, you can leave them on for 2 weeks without doing anything, and they're fine.
How do we know that?
Hashtag ask me how I know.
Hashtag Allstate Insurance.
Yeah. So can I want to go ahead and defend my statement about Metcal. If you look at new Metcals, they're over $1,000. But go onto eBay and just do a search for Metcal soldering iron. The one that I have is a PS2E, and it is I bought mine well over 25 years ago, and it was used at the time I got it. It's probably a 30 to 35 year old soldering iron, and the thing is still kicking it. And they are amazing. I will find the link to the YouTube video I saw, but there was a YouTube video I saw where someone described and explained the physics behind why these kinds of soldering irons work so well.
So describe from a user's point of view, like what is it about using it that makes it
so much better? It's the heat is instantaneous. It is capable of delivering so much energy so quick, but at the same time, to do that, it doesn't need to have a large thermal mass at the tip. So the problem with the normal soldering iron is that it can only deliver so much energy at any given time. And when your soldering iron is out in open air, it's not dissipating a whole lot of heat. So the mass, the thermal mass at your soldering tip gets nice and hot, but it's a big mass. And it needs to be a big mass because as soon as you touch it to something cold, like the thing you're soldering, it will suck all of that heat out of there. And if because it can't pump in enough energy to get it back up to temperature quickly, it will, you know, start getting down into temperature and then it like slowly starts getting back up. And it's just it's not a very responsive heat transfer. The Metcal, on the other hand, they have this, I'm not going to explain this right, so please don't email me, but I will find the link and put it in the show notes. But basically, there is this mechanism at the soldering tip where the resistance of the element changes with the temperature, I think. And so it's pumping a whole bunch of RF down the wire. It's actually RF that is spinning out. I was going to
ask, are these like inductive heating?
Inductive isn't the right term, but yes, basically. It's pumping a bunch of RF down the cable to the soldering tip, and then when it gets down to the tip, it has this element that changes its impedance with the temperature. And so the material itself sets the temperature of the tip. And it will just continuously shove more energy into it very quickly to get it back up to temperature. So as soon as you start touching whatever it is that you're trying to solder, as soon as the temperature goes down, it is sucking in more energy really quickly. And it's like soldering with butter. It's amazing.
So if you're shopping around for a brand new iron, so a brand new Weller or that other brand, Chevy, Ford, whatever. A good one is $100 plus or minus. So if you look at a Metcal iron, not like the best possible one, but if you were going to go buy one today, about how much would you expect to spend?
Honestly, I don't know. The MX500 is kind of their workhorse at this point, and I'm trying to find a price for one.
But we're probably looking at like $300 or something.
Certainly
like that.
Well over $100.
Oh yeah, it's $540 on Amazon right now.
Or you can buy probably a used one. Look for a really good used one.
And that is price. Yes, and that is the point that I wanted to put out. So the current MX500 you can get on eBay for about $250 used. The PS2E, like what I have, is about $175 used. You can find them cheaper, but they don't look very good shape, or they might come without the wand. The wand is actually kind of an important part to it. The tips are more expensive. They're about $15, not used, but you know, like in the surplus markets. And then I think they're about $25 new. So it's definitely a more expensive soldering iron, but it is such a better experience. So if you've got the Weller and the Hakko and you want to step it up a level, you will not go wrong with the Metcal.
By the way, I've seen a lot of Metcal irons at ham radio events, at flea markets, at Dayton. So it's very common to find used ones. And in fact, even buying a used, like a really good Weller, $150 Weller with a digital temperature control and all that stuff, you can find those used for half the price. So if you're really looking for a good deal, I think a very good condition used one, regardless of what price bracket you're in, is something to seriously think about because they're not that complicated. And typically the worst thing you're going to have to do is, you know, obviously put on a new tip, but maybe a new heating element or something someday. But rather than getting like a cheap crummy pencil iron for like $40, I would spend the $80 and get a good used professional one. Is a better way to go.
Yeah.
And I think
just on those. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that's why you get the Chevy Ford argument, is because you end up spending over that threshold to get into a decent iron, and that's the one that lasts you. It's not like any of us put 24/7 into these irons,
except me.
Well, for 2 weeks. You. That's a very good point. Okay,
no, that's 24/14.
But once you have this thing, it just runs. I have no complaints. I've had it since, well, for a very long time, and the thing just runs. So, but when you're getting into the $20, $40 range, not only is it being knocked off your bench onto the floor, burning something up, but it's just unpleasant to work with.
I'll give you my favorite example of the unpleasantness, especially with a pencil iron. And that is that, for the most part, cheap pencil irons, the AC cord has more mass than the pencil itself. So what that means is when you set the thing down, the stiffness of the AC power cord is going to like control where that iron rests and stays there, as opposed to having a nice weighted temperature controlled base that sits in one place and you can pop your iron in there and it's not going to walk around the bench, because the cheap ones that are going to walk around the bench will wind up in your lap, and it is not a pleasant experience. And you're going to burn the plastic of the AC cord. It's just save yourself the trouble.
No, that's a very good point. My daughter Emma's 14 now, but she started soldering things when she was about 12, and she started off at school with one of those traditional pencil. And you're right, the mass of the cord. She came home and tried mine out and went, "Dad, this is completely different." And I think sometimes we need to look at things from a usability perspective and from new eyes, and saying, you know, for another $50 used, you can be completely beyond this.
Yeah. And I mean, and I've told this story 100 times on the show, but I grew up, I knew people who had Wellers, and when I used them, they were fantastic, but I could only afford the like dual wattage 15, 45 watt Radio Shack pencils. And when I first invested in my Hakko, I realized I had been soldering incorrectly my entire life. Yep. I mean, it's that big of a deal. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I make a big deal about the Medcal. It's because I like it. It is definitely the Cadillac of soldering irons, right? It's not like you are going to miss out on the hobby by using a Weller or a Hakko. Those are both great brands. They make good soldering irons. I'm going to stay out of the religious wars on that one. You won't go wrong with either one of those.
Like,
but if you get to a point where you want to step up your game, then Medcal is the way to go.
Yeah, that's not you staying out of religious wars. That's you just choosing to ignore two factions.
And rising above it all.
That's right.
You know, so speaking of soldering, something that was new for me this year was I added the ability to do surface mount work relatively easily to my stable. And this was transformative as well. So what's funny is that one of the things that I was going to recommend, I looked and I noticed, Nick, you had put this on your list. Why don't you go ahead and share with us? And then I have a lot of comments about it.
Yep. So I picked up this. It's the same device under different brands. It's an 858D something or other, but it is a hot air rework station. And what it is, it's a base station that lets you control airflow and temperature, and then the wand itself has a heating element and a blower, and all it does is it sucks in air and blows it out hot, and you have some interchangeable tips that give you, you know, a larger cross-section or smaller cross-section of exit hole. And so when you're doing surface mount work, you can use either a solder paste and put down a bit of paste on each pad and put down your component and then heat it up, and paste melts and reflows, or you can use it for reworking surface mount stuff. It's the one I got was about $50. They seem to be in the $50 to $75 range. They're okay. You got to be careful. So it has a little magnet in the rest for the wand that triggers a little read switch. So it knows when you put the wand down, oh, I'm hung up now, and it turns off the heating element. It only works in certain orientations. And mine, for some reason, when the heating element is off and it's just sitting there idle, it will start buzzing from the power supply inside, which scares the heck out of me. But I've taken it apart a few times and checked on it, and so far there's nothing obviously wrong, but just in case, I am prepared for it to burst into flame at any moment.
Yeah, any machine can be a smoke machine if you use it wrong enough.
Yeah, unfortunately some of them come that way.
So let's talk a little bit about this device.
Glowing review.
Well, and here's the thing. This one in particular, you got to watch out for. I forget the name. The original company that manufactured these was called Atten, A-T-T-E-N. And I'm willing to bet if you take yours apart and look at the board, you will see that it actually does say like Atten 2012 on the PCB. These have been resold under various names, like I think one of them was Wen, W-E-N. The one you linked to was something else. W-E-P. Well, it says W-E-P, and then it says it's Kohre, K-O-H-R-E-E. So there were a ton of these dumped on the market in eBay. They were sold on Amazon, and there was an issue where the, I think it was the neutral and the ground were wired backwards in the case. And so people like, and I mean your AC mains, right? So people were touching metal parts, like the screws on the front of the thing, and getting shocked. So this is one of the things that kind of terrified me about this particular model. Now, MCM Electronics, when they were still around before they were absorbed into the larger Element 14 Newark Farnell mothership, their house brand Tenma also resold these. They were a little bit more expensive. I picked one up at Micro Center. I think it was $72 or $75. But you were guaranteed to get one that was not wired incorrectly, which to me was a big deal. The one that I had, I only had it for a little while. I ended up upgrading to a higher power model because I thought that's what I needed. And of course, what I actually learned is that I didn't know how to reflow solder paste is what it came down to. I think that for light duty work, or you just want to play around, this is a fantastic option. And in the show notes, I have linked to the one that is the Tenma brand, which is actually a slightly newer one. It's the same temperature adjustment settings. It still has a manual dial for the fan speed control, but then there is a way to set if there's a temperature you like to have as your favorite. There's a button for that. But it is really powerful. I got this originally to repair a micro USB connector that had broken off a board. And George, I don't know. Do you remember when I called you the first time I tried to SMD solder something with solder paste?
Yeah, I sure do.
Like, I don't know what's going on. The solder went dry and crumbly and it's not melting. And he's like, I don't know. I don't surface mount stuff.
Heat up. I think I'm going to guess you went with too low a temperature and just evaporated all of the flux away.
That's exactly right. And honestly, even now, so the unit I have now has a much more powerful fan and can get much hotter. But even now, it's like that desire to not burn things up has you starting too low. And in my case, every single time, it's like it goes through a phase where the flux evaporates. It goes dry, but then it all melts. And when it melts, it's like, it's instant. The wicking is instant. And really the lesson here is that I've been starting at too low of a temperature, but I'm sure experience will walk me in towards that.
Yep.
I think the experience is really important on this. I have not done enough surface mount stuff myself. I picked up a rework soldering station thing. And I've been able to successfully surface mount probably a couple dozen parts, chips, and probably 80% of the time it works fine. But I'd like to get my batting average up a little bit. The one that I use, I can't pronounce the name. It's A-O-Y-U-E.
That's what I have.
Pronounce it? Oh. So they make a bunch of different models, and I got one that was about $150. So it has a soldering iron on one side, and it's got the heat gun on the other side, and you can put different tips on it. And that seemed to work okay, but I think this is a case where a lot more practice would be useful.
Yeah. So there are these great little board kits on eBay. They're not actually, it's not a circuit that does anything. It's just a board that has a bunch of footprints, and it includes a bunch of just dud components.
You're describing most of my projects.
Well, these are, yeah, anyway. So these have...
they're actually designed to be duds.
Yeah. Oh, thanks.
1206, 0805, 0603, and 0402. And you take the board, and you just pick and place and solder, and get your practice in, and it's great for that. So you can start with the larger components and then work your way down and do that just over and over. And the kits are like, I don't know, $3 or $4 each. I'll make sure to get that in the show notes too.
One thing I want to point out really quickly about these hot air rework stations is that these are really meant for rework. Once you've got a surface mount component on a board that has an awful lot of pads and pins, you really kind of have to heat them all up at once to be able to get them off. And that's where the hot air rework station goes is good. If you are just trying to solder things onto a board, even at surface mount, I really do not recommend hot air rework stations as the right way to go. Get a super fine tip on your soldering iron and a super fine gauge of solder and a magnifier if you need it, and do it that way. But if you're trying to put something onto a board with a hot air station, in my experience, you spend more time picking up the parts off the floor because they blew away from the airflow.
Yeah, so this is what I was going to call out is... That's one of the things. So the model of the AOYUE station that I got, I opted not to get the one that had the soldering pencil. Mine has, it's basically a vacuum part holder. So there are a bunch of little tiny suction cups that are used for a lot of different sizes of components because, to Smitty's point, unless you get something where the airflow gets super low, you will often blow parts around. And you know, to you guys who've worked with solder paste, one of the other things that's kind of difficult. So I've been using, I think it's ChipQuick, and it comes in a syringe, but it's very difficult to get the solder paste to come out and then adhere to the pads of the board. Like, you end up having to kind of work it a little bit. But still, I mean, if you need this capability, spending between $75 and $150, you can get a workable instrument that I would not try to start a business with. But if you need to make a small repair or something, it is a worthwhile investment.
So while we're on this topic, what's been our experience, or has anybody got experience with toaster ovens with this sort of thing?
Yes.
Because my, you know, one of the fellows in the club is swears up and down that one, toaster ovens will do a wonderful job, and two, that viscosity is your friend, so that it will actually adjust the positioning of these little grain of rice components.
Yes. So the surface tension of the melted solder will pull your components straight into place, and it's really cool to watch. As far as toaster ovens doing it really well, you need a toaster oven that has top and bottom elements that are really powerful. It helps if it has a circulation fan. And you also need to add a lot of additional insulation to the oven. So if you basically stuff the entire empty shell of the body with like rock wool or something, and then put some reflective tape on the interior and on the window, that will help keep the temperature hot enough and stable that you can do your reflow. And then if you have a good controller on there too, so you can do the right reflow profiles. Otherwise, you will either just not get hot enough to reflow, or your heating cycle will be off and you will not reflow or cook your board. But if you can get all that working, then it's pretty cool.
Smitty, who's the gentleman you introduced me not directly, but you made me aware of who does the clock projects?
Nick Sawyer?
Yes. So he actually sells a toaster oven controller kit. So like that's a thing.
Yeah.
There's also there's a project out there called the X Toaster.
So Nick Karchukas on this call has one of those toaster controllers. You didn't build your own, did you, Nick?
No, I'm trying to remember which one I got. Let me see if I can find it.
Yeah, he is Geppetto Electronics is the name of his group or his company. Nick Sawyer, NWSAYER on Twitter. But yeah, so hot air reflow is definitely good to go if you've got, in my opinion, hot air is the way to go if you've got an awful lot of boards that you need to stuff. For me, when I'm doing onesie twosies, I'm still doing it by hand. Yeah. I can do 1206s by hand all day long. I can do 805s without too much trouble. I've done 603s, but they're kind of small. I'm not sure that I've ever tried a 402 or anything smaller than that. But whenever I design my boards, I design them with 1206s. I don't even bother with through hole anymore. Everything I do is all 1206 surface mount.
I don't always design boards, but when I do.
So the controller I have is the Controlio by Wizoo. I got it through a Kickstarter, so it was cheaper, but it looks like they're selling right now for $110, which is more than I remember paying. With when you're doing, to your point, Mark, if you have a bunch of boards to do, do it in a reflow oven, remember you still have to place all those components.
That's true.
You're only eliminating some of the work.
Yeah, but it's placing is a lot quicker and easier than actually soldering in. When I went and did 100 badges for this Hardware Hacking Village I did at work, I used a reflow oven. Nick's wasn't really ready at the time. I was using another friend of mine's reflow oven, and it made the work so much easier. Oh my gosh. But only because I was doing a whole bunch of them at the same time, right?
Any more tools to be put on the list?
I mean, I do have one question about where do you guys store all this? So it's all handy and ready to go.
I've got this little plastic rack bolted to the wall above my workbench that just has a bunch of little hangy thingies and holes in it. So my screwdrivers just drop into the holes and are held in place. My pliers are dropped into oblong holes, and then all my little needle nose pliers and my wire cutters sit on the hangy thingies. So I'll go ahead and link that in.
So when I was growing up, my mom used to always give me a hard time about the state of my room, saying, "How can you find anything in there?" My answer was always, "I know exactly where everything is in my room. It's on the floor." Which is exactly how my workbench is set up right now. All of my tools, everything I do is on the table, is on the workbench. So organize is not a word I would use to describe my workbench right now.
It's indexed chaos.
It is. I believe the term that Nick used at one point when describing a coffee table we used to have at our house is like, I think that's in the Decemberian era. So like, you know, the stratified layer of magazines and mail on your coffee table. You know, you can kind of identify roughly what month a thing was in, and he was able to identify it by the month.
So the last time I used my wire cutters was 3 months ago. That must be about 4 inches down from the top.
Exactly. Yes.
And when one is in the middle of a project, I heartily agree, but for marital bliss and maybe to satisfy some deep rooted OCD, I ended up getting myself a mechanics chest. In fact, I managed to find a small one, mechanics drawers. Because there are tools that I use about twice a year, but I absolutely positively need them. But I want to know where they are. And as I said, these lovely drawers, then there's something satisfying about the mechanism and having everything placed on the inside of it. And yes, I even go so far as labeling the outside, which is probably way over the top.
Have you gotten foam and done cutouts for the individual tools in the drawer?
Oh, those nice little like carpet. Like rubber carpet things on the inside? Absolutely. And
are they alphabetized? Do you put the cutters before the screwdrivers?
I only do that for cereal boxes, but still. yeah, it's a deep-rooted illness. But not to say that my shack is all that tidy, but it is when I need to find something, it's there. And it's been kind of satisfying, and maybe it was mostly about buying a beautiful stainless steel tool chest.
They are a thing of magic, aren't they?
They are. It's, I just like the sound that it makes when I roll it. So, yeah, that's my illness, and I'm okay with it.
So it's funny. My wife and I were out one Saturday morning, and she was very forcefully hinting that I should look at acquiring some of those style of tool cabinets and chests. And I mean, and the thing is, they're not cheap. Even from Harbor Freight, you're still out a couple of bills for one. And the thing is,
here's,
go ahead.
I was going to say, here's the trick. So when you're wandering around a Lowe's or something like that, look for the one that's on the display floor, because inevitably somebody lost the keys to it, which is exactly what happened to this one. And what do I need for keys? And one little conversation with the store manager, all of a sudden you're rolling out a 5 foot tall unit for $100.
Wow. And
yeah. Stainless steel. Pretty cool.
So it makes a great ground plane too.
It does. It's awesome.
You know, this is not necessarily Christmas related, but, you know, as we were talking about this, I told my wife, I said, well, when I finally get moved into the room that will be my, you know, office, I plan on covering the walls in storage cabinets and whatnot. And in the meantime, I don't want to invest in anything that's going on. So, we just went to a local, store and bought a bunch of Sterilite plastic containers so that I could get stuff that was on my workbench and on the floor into drawers. And I bought all kinds of different sizes, some that are perfect for holding like screws and whatnot. I got one that currently holds a bunch of different RF adapters and USB cables and USB power supplies. That's probably, I don't know, like 14 wide by 10 deep by, you know, four drawers that are each maybe 2 inches or 3 inches deep. But these things are relatively inexpensive and they're not durable. Like I wouldn't bang on them or sit on them or put heavy stuff on them, but they have been actually helpful, that there's now one place in my office to go get USB cables. Now,
yep.
The other thing that she pointed out to me is, paying attention to auctions around the area, like government auctions. My wife has a bead, and I'm not going to say where, because I really hope I wind up with these. But she is aware of an organization that is getting ready to have an auction here in a couple of weeks. And one of the things that they will be discarding are cabinets that were used to store and protect microfiche. And these cabinets are made out of steel and have wonderfully sized drawers and sold new for like $3,000. And like, you know, the starting bid is like $50. I'm sure they weigh 100 pounds a piece. But, you know, looking for some of this like heavier duty industrial or commercial type storage stuff is another good option.
So I have, so I lied a little bit about organization. I do have some organization in my office. I have a 6 foot rack. They're about a foot deep and they come with these little cardboard fold up bins for parts, you know, like the small ones are maybe 2 inches wide, the medium sized ones are 4 inches wide, and the big ones are 8 inches wide. And so I have all of my various different parts sorted and put into those bins, sorted into kind of broad categories and put into those bins on the shelf right next to my workbench. I also started recently acquiring these clear plastic bins from Costco. And the Costco by us has them. They're, you know, maybe a foot by 2 feet, if that even. I think it's a little less than a foot wide. But they've got a lid that goes on top and little handles on the sides that fold up over the lid to hold them in place. And they stack really nicely when they're empty. They also stack really nicely when they're full. If you put the lid on, they'll stack on top of each other. There are little recesses in the lid so that the bottom of the top bin fits into the recesses of the lid of the bottom bin, so they don't slide around too much. And they're, you know, you get six of them for less than $20. All right. So they're super inexpensive. They're not the most durable thing in the world, but they're clear so you can see what's in them, which kind of saves you the trouble of having to label them. Like you said, I've got one of these dedicated to USB cables, because later on in our show notes, we talk about consumables, and I listed USB cables on the consumables because I can never, ever, ever find the USB cable I need at the time. And so I'm always going back to my bin and grabbing a new one. I have no idea how or why USB cables are consumable in my life. You would think that you would need a fixed number of those, and once you've got them, you're done. But no, for some reason, they're consumable. Anyway, so I've got a bin full of those. So yeah, these little clear plastic bins have been absolutely amazing.
So that rack that Mark has, I had one for a bit, and it's kind of clunky for in the house. What I found, though, is those the boxes that it comes with fit perfectly, 7 across, in an IKEA Billy bookcase. And so now I have a bookcase stuffed with these boxes for all of my components.
So for my parts, I use the typical plastic little drawer things you get at the hardware store. And mounted some of those to the wall and put some on shelves. And for my tools on the bench, I use these really fancy cardboard boxes. So I kind of gave up on too much organizing for the tools I use day to day. And I have a couple of plastic or cardboard bins on the bench, about the size of a shoebox, but cut down a bit. And I have one for hand tools and one for bigger tools like crimpers and such. But the fancier thing is more the portable tool kit. So years and years ago, I bought a tool briefcase from Jensen Tools. So if you ever want to find the world's most expensive tools, get yourself a Jensen catalog.
And
give that to your spouse and say, pick anything. They'll never buy anything from it because everything's so expensive, especially when you look at the toolboxes, because you look at them and go, wow, that tool case is awesome for only like $300. And then you realize it's for the case. It's not for any of the tools.
It needs to be filled.
$1,200 worth of tools. I think I bought this thing like 20 plus years ago, and it looks like an old briefcase. And you open it up, and it's got a pallet on the top, and it's got a pallet on the bottom, and there are pockets for a complete set of hand tools. And I love that thing. It's one of those things, you buy and you'll keep forever. So that's really handy. I use that mostly when we're going to work on a repeater site, because I always want to make sure I have the right set of tools ready to go. And one thing that I feel very strongly about is having two different sets of tools. One set of tools that sits on the bench and a different set of tools that goes with me when I'm going somewhere, because there's nothing like spending your day, you get to the repeater site and realize that you left the spline wrench back on the bench and you just don't happen to have that crazy thing with you. So go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, George, I totally agree with that, because you inevitably leave something behind. I too had one of those. They're almost a telco maintenance guy type toolkit. Mm-hmm. In fact, I've still got it on a shelf here, but I've actually recently retired that in favor of, it's a little company called Veto Pro Pack, VETO. Put that in the show notes too. And they started out making vertical tool bags. So you unzip the side of this, and it's mostly for carpenters and trades and that kind of thing. But they've recently started making technician versions of these. Now, they're not cheap, but the one that I had for building, I have had for many, many years, and it has been thrown into the back of a pickup and just generally abused. It's probably, again, 20 years old and has been loaned out and has been all over the place. Well, I've recently got one of their technician versions of it. I think they call it the MCT. Don't know what that stands for, but there's technician in there somewhere. And the real advantage is, instead of digging in the bottom of a tool bag, it's all vertical. You see all the handles. You simply zip down one side. And one of the projects I'm working right now is putting together a toolkit for my daughter's robotics team. And I'm sorely tempted to go get one of these for them, even though they're a little pricey.
So this idea of having the different sets of tools is really a lifesaver, because like you said, Rod, you'll go somewhere and realize you left the one thing behind. The other thing is, like for our field day, I use a completely different set of tools for field day because they may not come back with me. And that's the perfect time to go buy a set of whatever from Harbor Freight, because if you leave it in the rain, or somebody walks off with it by mistake or whatever, you leave it at the park by accident, you're not going to kick yourself for leaving your $50 wrench at the park. So you might even think of having like a kick around set of tools that you really kind of don't care what happens to them.
Yeah. Speaking of consumables.
Yeah, exactly.
So kind of on the flip side of that, we talk a little bit later about test equipment. One of the things that was one of the best purchases I've made in a long time at the flea market up in the Bay Area. I ran across a guy who was selling these bench top or like shelf top multimeters. It's just a multimeter, right? Ohms, volts, amps. It is nothing special inside of it, except for the fact that it is a big box instead of a small handheld thing, and it's front mounted. So it takes up, maybe 7 or 8 inches width and only about 3 or 4 inches tall on the shelf. But it's the banana plugs come out the front for the leads, and you got all the buttons on the front and everything. And it's great for mounting on a shelf above your workbench, and it never leaves. It's AC powered. It's not battery. It's not going to walk away. So I've always got a multimeter on my bench. And that has been so amazingly useful, as opposed to it's like, all right, where did I put my handheld multimeter? I can't find it. Oh, I got the meter, but the probes went missing or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. None of that stuff anymore, because I've got this thing on my bench all the time.
Yeah, I think that philosophy is really an important point, that you wind up eventually having a set of stuff for the bench and a set of stuff to go. And that, I think that really lets you do things like get bigger stuff you wouldn't carry around or bolt it down so you just don't happen to lug it and then leave it somewhere.
Yeah.
I think that's a great point. And by the way, Rod, I looked at the website real quick. I've never heard of this brand, Vito Pro Pack, but they've got, there's a lot of really nice looking bags here. So that's a great tip. Cost me some money, I think.
I think so. I knew that would be right up your alley.
Totally.
The guy that launched the company was a trades guy, and he went from literally back of the catalog sales, which is where I found it to begin with. Now he's got a rather large company. So I'm quite, it's nice to see somebody that builds a good product and be successful with it.
It looks like they're really rugged.
Yeah, I like the, it looks like they've got a solid plastic base. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, you can literally put it in a puddle up to about 2 inches deep.
That's nice.
It's solid, molded, completely leak-proof on the bottom.
So this is quickly turning into my money, not other people's money.
It's, well, that's how we get our revenge.
Right. So apparently I've started something. When we were talking about how dirty my workbench was, I went ahead and posted a picture on Twitter of my workbench. And mentioned you all. So if you check your Twitter stream, you can see a picture of just how bad my workbench is right now. And then Nick replied to it. And then Rex, KE6MT, another Ham Radio 360 alum, has replied to it. And I've gotten a couple of comments from other people as well. So this might be a show us your workbench kind of thread starting here.
All right. I'm going to post my pic.
I want to see it.
And I just got to figure out how to use this Twitter thing. How do you young whippersnappers use this Twitter?
So another consumable item that I want to talk about, RF adapters. So we've got several different standards in the ham radio community, and the entire industry is kind of settled on a few, which is kind of nice. It's not one. It would be nice if it were just one connector, but there are different needs and different requirements for RF connectors. So we've settled on several different types. Probably the most common in the ham world, unfortunately, is the PL259 or SO238 or UHF connector, or whatever the heck you want to call it.
239. Let's get it right.
Okay. That one. Those
pedantic people like me.
So the PL259, 230, wait, what is it?
It's a PL259 is the male, SO239 is the female.
Okay. So what he said, that connector, but some of the other common ones are BNC and N connectors, which are actually kind of cousins of each other. They're, I think, just different power handling capabilities, but electrically they're very similar. You can actually put a N connector, an N male onto a BNC female, and you won't break anything. And then the kind of the fourth one is SMA. And those are the four connector types, and then you got the male and the females on each of those. But so often you will have a radio that's got one connector type and you'll need to plug it into a cable that's a different connector type or whatever, right? And so what I got into the habit of just buying bulk adapters that switch from one type to another. And then invariably you create a thing and it's got one connector type on it. And then you want to go put it into a project that has another connector type. And so you get the adapter to go between those two and it becomes a permanent part of the project. So I guess what I'm saying is don't be afraid to make an adapter a consumable item and make it an official part of your project and be prepared for that and have some, you know, maybe buy a 5-pack of a BNC male to an SMA female, you know, or whatever kind of adapter types are going to be common in your shack. And just have those on hand. And similarly, have the connectors, like crimp-on connectors, to go onto cable. You know, I've got a big spool of LMR 400 Ultraflex that I bought when I moved into my house, and I ran, you know, probably 300 of the 500 feet on the spool around the house. And so I've still got about 200 feet on this spool left over. And occasionally I'll cut off a 6-foot section or a, you know, whatever I need for the thing. And so I've got some LMR 400 connectors sitting in one of those cardboard boxes on my shelf and a crimp tool. And I can literally just whip up whatever cable I need with whatever connector on it. And the LMR 400 connector types, I've got N connectors. I got, PL259s because it's a male. And I've got some BNC, right? I don't think I have any SMAs for the LMR 400 because that would just be silly. But I've got these things in bulk and it makes it very convenient to be able to connect things together when you need to.
Yeah, that's a really good call out. I mean, like part of my Dayton ritual every year is to basically buy a giant handful of various adapters. Because you're right, they are consumable. In fact, actually, I went through over the last couple of weeks. I've done two things. I have a bunch of those clear plastic storage bins from Costco, but they're the industrial kind with like the interlocking, like permanently attached lids. So I went through a bunch of those to clean them out and consolidated. And I walked away with one bin full of random cables and then a shoebox. Well, not full, but a good number of RF connectors that were connected to things that weren't used anymore. And so I consolidated them all and now have a drawer of just those RF connectors. And the USB cables, I found so many cables. I think I know where you're losing all of yours to.
They're like socks in the dryer. Seriously.
Yeah.
You have no idea where they go.
Well, what's funny is as I'm going through this, I'm pulling out like, and I found some super high end cables that like have, the ferrites, I forget what they call them, but I mean the chokes built into them on both ends. Mm-hmm. Like I'm thinking to myself, I know I did not buy this on its own. Like what did I buy sometime in the last 10 years that came with this cable?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you develop a romantic attachment to these things. I recently cleared out 4 large Rubbermaid containers of cables, which included Cisco router cables from I don't know when. And why I held on to these things, I have no idea.
Because you might need them someday.
Well, so
the funny thing, I just threw away a couple weeks ago, I threw away like 10 Cisco console cables. And then 1 week ago, I realized, uh-oh, I need a Cisco console cable.
Yeah, I just bought 2 of them at Weird Stuff. I didn't know you were throwing them away.
Well, too late. Those were gone. Those were gone before we started that project anyway.
Yeah. So one other tool. So we, by the way, thank you for posting your bench pics, Jeremy and Rod. Those are some pretty amazing pictures. But there are a couple of things in here that I want to point out that made me that I looked at and said, oh, my gosh, that's so awesome. We need to have on the list a label maker.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. All Brother. Of us are like, oh, of course. But we didn't think about it ahead of time. Label makers.
You know, Amazon routinely has an introductory, I think it's a Dymo 160 that is routinely available for $10. It's like usually 20, but it's on sale like every other minute.
Well, you have to remember your consumables. It's just like the inkjet printers, right? Yep. You want to make sure that whatever label making that you're doing is affordable at some point, because that bargain labeler is not going to be a bargain when you're spending $50 on a label cartridge.
Oh, you're right. And the worst part is, which fortunately these like standard half inch by 23 foot is like less than $5. But what's frustrating about a lot of these label makers is the excess label on the, you know, before and after your text that it prints to make you go through them more quickly.
Something else I found with inexpensive label makers is if you get one that's battery operated, well, you shouldn't have gotten that, because they eat batteries like you wouldn't believe. Try and get one that plugs in.
Huh. So I would agree with that, but I'll say, so like the thing that prompted this, I had, there's, I don't even know what brand it is, but this label maker on the bench behind me here is 12 or 13 years old. And it's large enough that it actually takes 6 AA's instead of like 2. And batteries last in it forever.
I've got one of those Brother label makers, and I don't think I go through batteries too quickly on that thing, but I do certainly go through expensive tape on that. So Costco's your friend.
Well, there's a point in and of itself is, what batteries do you end up using? Because one of the things in my hand is a very small multimeter that was made by Tech at one point, the DMM 150. I love this thing. I just dug it out recently because it's a pen style. But the key to it is it uses 2 AA's. And something that I've been noticing lately is I'm starting to ditch the things that have specialty batteries and trying to go to some sort of common battery, so that I've got one rack of batteries, you know, of the common sizes within the workshop, because inevitably my ancient antenna analyzer will need batteries, or something else will need batteries. And if I'm looking for coin batteries somewhere, that's going to be a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think I've pretty much gone to AA's and AAA's where at all possible. I know a lot of really cool flashlights use crazy batteries, but I've pretty much avoided that, even though they're smaller.
I have added CR2032s to my standard battery collection because they're pretty ubiquitous. A lot of things use CR2032s. But you're right. Anytime you got some weird off size or off voltage coin cell, those are just kind of a pain in the butt.
So I want to plug a couple of other hand tools before I jump over to the list of consumables I have. So I just want to run through these really quick, if that's okay.
Sure.
So I have a couple of Heiko flush cutters. They're the CHP-170. They're just little nippers, but they're extremely sharp, and the cutting edge goes pretty much completely flat against the bottom of the cutter. So you can get very, very flat cutoffs with them. They're really nice, and they're only like $5 a piece. Something else I use a lot is my iFixit screwdriver kit. It's got a bunch of different sizes of all sorts of screwdrivers, Phillips, flathead, Torx, pentalobe, trilobe, etc. And they have a kit for with like 64 different bits. It's about $30.
You just gave the answer to my favorite trivia question.
What's that?
What is the name of the screwdriver that you use to take apart your Apple MacBook Air?
Yeah, it's iFixit.
It's a pentalobe.
Pentalobe, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, George, you have to remember that iFixit is a local company here. I actually go to lunch with some of the guys over there every once in a while. So.
Oh, no kidding. By the way, I totally second the iFixit thing. I got one of their multi-tool sets with the bits and the, what do they call it, a spludger?
Yep.
Spudger.
And their tools are great. Those kits are wonderful.
And one more thing that I realized actually gets the most use out of anything on my workbench. I don't remember if this was pre-show or when we were recording, but Jeremy maybe made the joke about having Italian marble as your workbench surface. So I have I think it was $1 or $2, a 16-inch square ceramic tile on my desk that is my soldering surface. It is impossible to burn.
Challenge absolutely. Accepted. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, that's I've used that that tile on your desk before, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is amazing.
Yeah, and if you drip solder on it, it just pops right off after, and they're really handy for that.
Sorry, Rod, I talked over you. What were you going to say?
No, I was going to second that. We actually have a stack of them that we have these little project parties within the club, and we've used those as handouts, basically, so that somebody's dining room table doesn't get destroyed. Makes the spouses very happy.
Yeah. We need to have a better local club.
Well, you have a virtual club right here.
We do, but it's kind of hard to get together with a virtual club to go build things.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. So we want to move on to consumables, since I've kind of already touched on that.
Yeah, let's do that. So what else do you have in your consumables list?
Well, actually, I was going to pass it to you, because the one that's at the top of your list is the one that I think everyone, everywhere needs.
And that would be a gigantic bag of power pole connectors.
Absolutely.
And I swear, you joke around about like saying USB cables are consumables, and these bleeping connectors, I'd buy a bag of like 30 of these things thinking, well, that'll last me until, I don't know, a long time from now. And then like a month later, it's like, I need more connectors.
Yeah.
And I'm not exactly sure where all these things are going. I don't have that many radios. But we've absolutely gone down the path of power pulling the whole shack. So everything that's a 12-volt DC connection is a power pull. I think maybe one of you guys mentioned, with the exception of low current DC connectors that are 2.1 millimeter barrel connectors, and that's, I kind of buy into that too. But for anything above a couple amps, power pole the way to go. And I would certainly get the power pole crimping tool. We've talked about that a lot in the past, but that's kind of a no-brainer. If you're going to put on more than, 10 of those pin things, then having the crimper is very handy.
Absolutely. So
not only have I gone to power pole with all of my ham stuff, I've also gone to it with all of my RC aircraft. Almost all.
Interesting, because there's tons of weird bullet connectors.
Bullet connectors, there are the XT60s and so forth. So I've got a couple of small racing quads, and those still use either the XT60s or whatnot, just because they're so small. But my larger plane and my larger quad, I've switched those over to power poles, and they're just so much easier to connect and nice and solid.
So I've mentioned this a few minutes ago. I'm entering a dangerous era as my daughter's get into robotics. And what I discovered last week going to one of the conferences is the first robotics organization uses power poles.
Oh, nice.
For the big battery, yeah.
For the big battery, both the big battery and the very large diameter, but mm-hmm. also for sub-assemblies. Many of the teams use the sizes that we would normally use. Mm-hmm. So I fully anticipate that my kids are going to be raiding my supplies of power poles. That's where mine will go.
Doesn't that mean you get to expense the replacements?
Exactly. I'm doing it for the kids. What?
That's right.
Well, you might want to buy a couple of hundred extras just in case.
You just never know.
You can't power pole the world if you don't have enough power poles.
That's right.
It's a big world out there.
So the real question is, though, I don't remember where I saw this, but somebody was saying that it might have actually, Rod, was it you that was saying that that yes, they're using power poles, but they're orienting the polarity backwards?
Oh, great.
I was worried about that. And the first answer I got was, yes, it was backwards. But unfortunately, I was talking to the wrong person as I discover more and more things about FIRST Robotics. No, they're doing it what we would consider to be the right way. But I will be watching very closely as I go to these competitions to see that how the orientations work.
Hey, actually, this brings up kind of a side note. Randy, K7AGE, who has a relatively well-known YouTube channel, actually did a small project to basically build a power pole polarity tester. he stuck in a two color LED, and when it's correct, it'll light green, and when it's wrong, it'll light red. I'll have to try to find the link to that, because that might be a handy project that you want to invest in prior to going much further down this road.
That's a great idea.
George, by the way, you're fired. Your workbench is way too clean.
That was after a manic weekend of cleaning up.
I have a consumable to talk about that I don't, it won't apply to everybody, but as you all know, I am on a crusade to add to the relevance of 3D printing in our hobby. I just will give a quick mention of my favorite filament that is a perfect balance of cost to quality, and that's a company called Hatchbox, Hatchbox. I love their PLA in particular, although their ABS and their PETG are also well-regarded. The biggest challenge is for a long time they were having a significant issue keeping up with demand for their filaments. Best place to find it is on Amazon, and if it's the kind of thing you need, it's kind of buy it when you see it. Stock up on it, and a kilogram goes for about $22 to $26 American, depending on what color and whatnot. And I remember back when I was able to get that stuff for like $16-18 a kilogram, but it's gone up in price a little bit, but that's still pretty cheap for the quality.
Nice. I haven't actually started investing in good filament yet. I'm still using the monoprice filament, but it also hasn't failed to do anything I need it to do yet. So, but I'm sure it will at some point. Actually, that's not true, because I tried using ABS and it was rubbish. Yes. But the PLA filament is pretty good. Oh my God, George. Sorry, he posted another picture of all of his parts bins.
Yeah, I'll make sure. I'm going right now onto Twitter to pull this thread so we can make sure that folks can... Oh my gosh, George.
Right? You're totally fired.
George, for the folks who don't have the pictures in front of them, describe the way you have built your parts bins. Are you muted?
Oh yeah, I should press the button. So you go to the hardware store and they have these plastic parts bins with all the little drawers, right? And so I had like a pair of those, but I blew out of that. So I got another pair and I blew out of that. And so I realized there's these shelves that I built that are about 20 inches deep or so. And I thought, I know what, I'll put a set of bins in the back on the wall, and then I'll put another set of bins in front of them and build doors and mount them to the doors. So when you look at that picture, the red one and the blue one that are on the sides, those are actually on hinged doors that swing shut. So the fronts of the parts bins face each other when the thing's closed up. So it's neat. Anyway, so that's only a part of them. I mean, there's more parts bins on the bench too.
You know, real quickly about parts bins, I can't believe I didn't mention this earlier. So one of my favorite companies is a company called Acro Mills, AKRO-MILS. All the parts bins, I've switched to Acro Mills parts bins just because there's a good variety. They're made of a solid, sturdy plastic. They average like $25 to $30 a piece for the multi-parts bins, which I've put a link in the show notes to Amazon. But I recently visited their website and saw their catalog, and man, you want to talk about a company that makes storage for everything. They have some things that when I do move into my office, I will just cover one entire wall in their storage stuff.
These are like plastic bins?
Yes. And everything from like the little parts bins, like you're showing with the little drawers, to the more traditional ones that kind of have like the angled front that you might keep screws, nuts, and bolts in. Plus everything you could ever want to attach them to, from wall mounts to cabinets to trolleys.
Rod, the feed.
Someone's got all Cylon on us.
Rod.
Did he just say exterminate? I thought I heard him say that.
Exterminate. Yes.
Yep. Unplug and plug it back in.
Okay, we'll do.
So while he's doing that, yeah, those Acro Mill bins, we had those at a company I used to work at up in the Bay Area called Haltech, and that's what I was looking for when I found I found them and I got sticker shock and I said, yeah, no, I'm not going to spend that much money on bins. And that's when I ended up finding the cardboard solution.
You used to work at Haltech. I used to shop at Haltech.
I know. We've discussed this before. When I was in high school, probably 91 to 94-ish.
I'll be darned. Yeah, I bought a lot of junk in there, like old chassis boxes to be stripped to use the aluminum and such. That was a great place.
Yeah, I sold a lot of junk there. That's actually where I got my Metcal. So it came in on a pallet of stuff and was not working. The final output transistor on the amplifier needed to be replaced. Well, it just so happened that I worked at a place that sold a crap ton of transistors. So I walked out into, opened up the soldering iron, looked at the part number on the transistor, went over to our transistor wall, found a replacement transistor, and right then and there at the sales counter, whipped out the soldering iron, swapped out the transistor, and got the thing working again. And it was mine for $20.
Wow.
Deal.
Nice.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else do we have in the consumables list that... That's useful. So we went through RF adapters, cables, chokes. Smitty, you have chokes on your list.
I do have chokes on my list. So there's a company up in Sunnyvale called Weird Stuff, and it is very aptly named. It's kind of along the same spirit of Haltech, where it's just a bunch of old crap, I'll call it that. But there are some gems in there as well. And one of the things I found was a plastic bag with these really nicely oriented, lined up. It wasn't just a grab bag, stuff thrown in there. They were actually lined up in a nice, clean lines of, but they're these snap-on ferrite beads that go over cables. And there were 50 of them for $20, which is the best price I've ever found for these. I bought them without knowing anything about the mix of the ferrite or without knowing the diameter of the wire that would fit through it, just because it was such a great deal. Turns out they fit perfectly over RG58. I still don't know what the mix is, but if you're trying to choke RF, I don't think it matters all of that much.
It does actually, because the impedance of the choke is a function of the mix at a particular frequency. So a lot of the ones you commonly find that are put in consumer electronics tend to be high frequency, as in very high frequency mixes to keep out VHF rather than HF. In general, I mean, that's not universally true, but like on most consumer electronics, DC power cables with a choke in line, they're really not chokes that you would use to build like an HF
Ballon,
RF choke. Yeah.
No, you're right. Excuse me. Yeah, you're absolutely right, because it's probably there to block out, FM broadcast and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, so far, the only time I've used one of these is in building a 2 meter double cross dipole antenna for satellite work. And so I'm kind of assuming that they'll probably, two of them on each dipole will probably do a reasonably good job of choking that off.
Let's see. Well, we're still on consumables.
Yeah. So speaking of consumables, one of the things that I put on my list, because I just came across these earlier this year. So for project stuff, as somebody who's still relatively new in the tinkering and building of electronics, when I did the MIDI mute button, I needed some 220 ohm resistors. I didn't really want to mail order it and wait for it. I was able to run up to Micro Center. I think I spent $2 for 4 resistors, which of course is an astronomical price. They're quarter watt metal film 1% resistors, which is fantastic. But I realized that I needed to start building a library of common resistors, capacitors, maybe diodes, whatever, but discrete passives. And one of the things that I came across, and this is just an example, but on Amazon, there was this brand that was called Cute Queen, which is pretty meaningless. But for less than $7, I got 30 different values of resistors, 10 resistors each, and they come pre-sorted in little individual like Ziploc baggies.
Well, actually, that's a really good point. Having a set of all the common resistors and similarly a set of common capacitors and diodes and transistors is a good thing to have. That's one reason why when you look at all these parts bins, there's one parts bin that's nothing but resistors sorted by value, because you know you never know when you need that 33K yeah. resistor.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've actually got three parts bins because it wouldn't fit in one. So I've got all of my, ones, tens, and hundreds in one bin, all my K ohms in another bin, and all my meg ohms in a third bin.
You know, can find those decade series for surface mount stuff too on eBay. The sets are like $10 to $20. Yep, resistors, capacitors, inductors, and they come in cut tape.
All right. What other consumables?
So I've got solder on my list. And my favorite, I still use leaded solder, and I love 6337. It just melts and solidifies to me nicer than 6040. And so I bought a 1 pound spool of Kester leaded, like 5 rosin core, 15 thou diameter solder, $33. And I anticipate having to replace it sometime around when I am 68 years old.
Yeah, so I hesitated to list solder as a consumable because I just had to buy a new roll of solder to replace the one I bought in high school.
Yeah, it is consumable, just it lasts
very,
you a
very
while.
Slowly.
The okay, soldering well, consumable that I use much more rapidly, however, is solder wick. Braid. And that's that copper wick that you use to undo your creative artistic displays of solder on your board.
Yeah, solder wick is a must-have.
I go through a lot more of that because somehow it ends up in my pocket and into the washing machine, which comes out a lovely, lovely copper color.
Your laundry does.
That too, yes.
Yeah. You have to be careful with that because I think those solder wicks are impregnated with flux. With extra flux to make it go. So washing it probably makes it kind of useless at that point.
Yeah.
It hasn't worked well since, but that's all good.
Yeah.
What I also tend to go through a lot of is heat shrink.
Oh, yeah.
And then what I recently discovered is glue-lined heat shrink. So when you apply it and heat it up, it squeezes down and also it heats up this basically like a hot glue inside. And so this is really good for putting over crimped connectors, like RF connectors, and it'll glue it down and make it nice and weather tight.
Yeah, 100% on that. I agree.
That is something that I don't have. So I need to buy a bunch of that. I have regular heat shrink, and I used to think the hot tip, so to speak, was to make sure you get the heat shrink, the good stuff that you can actually heat not only with a heat gun, but with a soldering iron tip and not have it just turn into a puddle of plastic. So don't use cheap heat shrink. Use the good stuff. But I haven't found the stuff with the adhesive in it. Where did you get it?
That was just off Amazon. It was like, what was it, $12 for a kit of different sizes.
Oh, that's on my list.
And interesting factoid about heat shrink. Apparently the way it's made is they pass it through a particle accelerator to get the structure of the polymer to arrange in a certain way.
Huh. Today I learned.
Does anybody have a plan for a home-size particle accelerator for their workbench to make their own heat shrink tubing?
Maybe you can 3D print one.
The Department of Energy would probably want to have words with you.
I tried it with a flux capacitor, but it doesn't work as well.
Were you going 88 miles an hour?
Maybe that was it.
In your rocket 88?
Yeah, that would be it.
All righty. Well, I think let's take a break. And when we come back, we will start.
2 hours into the show. Now it's time to take a break.
We will start digging into test equipment.
This episode of The Workbench is brought to you by Autodesk Eagle PCB Design Tools. All of our projects we're doing on the workbench use Eagle. It's great for schematic capture and board layout. You can easily generate all of the output files necessary to manufacture a circuit board. And whether you're building one board or 100 boards for your friends, Use Eagle Tools because they have really excellent support. They've got a great library of available components. It's widely used amongst the maker and the professional board design tool. You'll enjoy using the tools, and there's a lot of great new features. Check it out at autodesk.com/eagle, and you could download a free copy of the PCB design tool today and get started doing your project.
So we've covered a lot of stuff as far as different tools and capabilities to add to your workbench. We've covered our most common things that we tend to run through as consumables. One of the bigger categories, and this is tend to be where most of the expensive stuff is in test equipment. George, what would be on your list for test equipment as your Christmas wish list?
So we talked about test equipment in the first few episodes of the podcast, and I didn't really want to retread over the basics for test equipment. So I was thinking, well, what would be either almost in the stocking stuffer category, but or in the kind of quirky category? And so I came up with two items. The first one is the Elecraft XG3. So this is a handheld signal generator. So it's an RF sig gen. And if you're building receivers and you need a signal source to align the receiver, then you'd want something like the XG3. But the thing that's interesting about it is they added some clever firmware. So there's actually a couple of different modes of operation that are built into the sig gen. So besides generating a continuous carrier to do things like receiver alignment, the thing could send CW automatically. So if you want to make a like an HF beacon, this thing could be a little baby super low power beacon transmitter. Or if you want to do a fox hunt, you know, a direction finding signal, you know, T-hunt, transmitter hunt event, and you don't want to build the fox hunt transmitter, you can use this signal generator as that, because you can program it to send a CW message and to transmit for, you know, not on all the time. So it's really a pretty useful little piece of test equipment. And I think they're probably about $100. They're not that terribly expensive. So that would be one, especially if you're doing receiver design, so, or receiver building. Like, for example, the BitX. If you built a BitX and wanted to test it, besides being on the air, you could use something like this XG3 as a signal generator. The second thing that I would suggest is a very small, universal piece of test equipment. And I have one of these things, and I absolutely love it. So this is a little gadget called an Analog Discovery. And they're on the second generation. So it's the Analog Discovery 2. It's by a company called Digilint. And Digilint makes all kinds of interesting pieces of, I would say, kind of test equipment, but also development boards and project boards. And they started business focusing on building project boards for university classes in electronics and embedded systems. And this Analog Discovery is about the size of a hockey puck. And it's USB connected to your PC, and there's some really cool software that runs on the PC that talks to this little puck. And on the other end of the puck is a big header connector. So there's about a 2x20 or so big header. And on those pins are a bunch of test equipment electronics. So this thing is a two-channel oscilloscope. It's a two-channel arbitrary waveform generator, 16-channel logic analyzer, 16-channel pattern generator. It'll do a voltmeter, AC and DC. It'll do some forms of network analysis, probably more useful in low-frequency applications and maybe audio. Spectrum analyzer in the audio domain to do things like signal-to-noise ratio, total harmonic distortion, stuff like that. Bus analyzer, SPI, I2C, UART. And it has two programmable power supply outputs. So this little gadget has got like six pieces of basic test equipment all built into one little tiny box. And the user interface is all software. And it's really awesome. I think if I were setting up a bench, I would normally think about getting boxed instruments that are kind of big with knobs and big displays. But if you want something that takes up almost no room and is very portable, this thing is pretty awesome. And so I know, Nick, you had picked this one also as a interesting device too.
Yeah, it combines a whole lot of features. So if you're budget limited and can't really go with all of the set of discrete stuff, or space limited, like you said, it's really a great choice. And especially if you're a student, you get a discount of $100 off. So this normal retail price is $279, or the educational discount is at $179.
So I'd also like to point out that I'm on their Digilint website right now. They have a bundle, the Digilint plus a little breakout board that breaks it out into BNC connectors for the scope probes. And then it also comes with a pair of scope probes. And this is a bundle that they're doing with Contextual Electronics, which is Chris, and I'm blanking on his last name, Chris from the AmpHour podcast. Chris Gammel from the AmpHour podcast. So that was kind of neat. I've met Chris once. I like him a lot.
So I got that little breakout board that it snaps on the side with the four BNCs. Two are for scopes and two are for signal generators. So that way you have conventional connections. When you first look at this thing, by the way, you realize that the IO is not a big connector. I mean, it's not like a big rugged connector. It's a header. And you think, wow, that's kind of weird. How in the world am I going to get to that? What occurred to me was almost all the projects that I build have headers on the circuit boards anyway. And a lot of the IO going into and out of a lot of projects already have headers. And so you can just get these little jumper wires that have female headers on the wire. And so you could just use that. And I've done that. In fact, I needed to adapt regular probes to that kind of connector anyway. So it turns out that's actually pretty handy. And if you do want to expand it into regular real connectors, there are some options for that. So the reason why I love that thing is because it is so small and portable. So if you ever travel and have to take your oscilloscope with you, this is a super compact kind of alternative.
Yeah, don't laugh. I mean, I took my Saley with me to to DEF CON for the Hardware Hacking Village. I knew they were going to be having some awesome digital badge, and I didn't know what it was going to be or what we were going to need to do with it. So I wanted to take all of my gear with me, and all I had at the time was the Saley, the little tiny logic analyzer. It's basically just the logic analyzer part of this. The one I have, I think, is only 8 channels. It's a little tiny one. But having something like this, you could throw in your laptop bag with a couple of scope probes, and you have, you know, a full test suite right there with you in your hotel room at DEF CON for maximum hacking.
I hate to admit this to normal people, but I've actually taken my Analog Discovery and a little board that I designed on a business trip. So sitting in the hotel room late at night with nothing else to do, I'm like debugging the circuit with my little Analog Discovery. So
yeah, that's great.
Yeah, they're really handy. So let's see. So Smitty, what did you pick for test equipment?
For test equipment, I already kind of touched on it. The $20 multimeter, benchtop multimeter. Honestly, of the test equipment that I have purchased, that is the one that I use the most. And as for benefit for dollar, it wins far and away because it was super cheap and because I use it so much. But I kind of already talked about that one. So I would be happy to spend $100 on that thing. So I highly recommend getting one of those that stays at your test bench. The other thing I put on the show notes, and I don't know that it really qualifies for what we're talking about here, but I'm going to list it anyway. I've been getting into QRP kits, right? You know, we've talked about the BitX 40. I also recently assembled a QCX, from QRP Labs. It's a little tiny monoband, class E CW transmitter, really kind of unique design. It's really interesting. I recommend checking that out. We'll talk about that in a different show. But I've got all of these QRP things, and it dawned on me, I have no way of testing it. I have no idea how much power I'm putting out, for example. I don't have a watt meter that'll read that low. I don't have an SWR meter that will work at that low level, right? So I need to start improving my QRP test gear game in that level, and I don't have an answer to it yet is part of the problem. You look online and there are some things that you can get. You can spend buckets of money on commercial products that will do this, but we're talking small enough power here that I should be able to make something. And I've been kind of piecing together bits and pieces of designs of things that I kind of want to put into a single box, something that has a forward and reverse, you know, like a directional coupler power meter, so I can read forward and reverse power And from that, you can get SWR, something with a dummy load built into it, something with a frequency counter built into it would be nice, and maybe a simple tuner as well. But have all of that stuff in a single box that is good down to QRP power levels is something that I really want to kind of build. I've been actually looking at the Noga Watt, N-O-G-A, Northern Georgia QRP Club. They designed a kit called the Noga Watt that's does not involve the resistive bridges, which, you know, where you lose most of your power. So you can actually leave it in line with your signal most of the time. So that was kind of the one that I was going to base it off of.
Okay, let's see. And Jeremy?
I don't really have anything on the test equipment side that either hasn't been covered in depth before or that Nick won't cover here in a moment. I mean, really, the only thing that comes to mind, and this isn't strictly test equipment, but I think it's a useful tool for spectrum analysis. And as I have made plainly clear, I am a huge fan of the AirSpy series of SDR boxes and dongles. There's the AirSpy Mini, which is basically directly plug into a USB port, the AirSpy R2, and the newly released AirSpy HF Plus, which I hope to have sometime in the next week. I'm going to say stay tuned on this because Barrick, our friend Barrick, K6BEZ, has been doing work about building or basically enabling you to have a poor man spectrum analyzer using dongles such as this. And so some of the work he is doing has been talking about, I think, could actually turn this into a pretty close approximation for having a spectrum analyzer without having to dump, you know, $1,500 to $2,000.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And I know that's something that he's interested in doing also, just in general, low-cost RF test equipment. Nick, anything else on your list?
Oh, where to begin?
Tell us about the Bus Pirate.
Okay, so the Bus Pirate is a neat little device. It's a little under $30. And what it is, it's basically a USB port on one side and various UART protocols out to the other. So you can use it to talk to various TTL serial devices, I2C devices, SPI devices, etc. And it's neat to be able to just kind of inject commands into devices that you're testing or something, components that you're playing with, without having to hook up a microcontroller and write a bunch of code.
Those things are available from Seed Studio, I think.
Seed Studio and a couple other places. And they're easy to use. You plug in your USB cable and it presents as a serial port. You connect to that and it gives you a nifty little, basically just a terminal interface where you have a couple of little basic text menus and it walks you through what you can do. It's nice.
See, what else do you have on your list?
So I've got a couple of little inexpensive things that I picked up from eBay. I have a little component tester that was about $15. That thing is pretty cool if you have a bunch of assorted discrete silicon semiconductors on your desk. You don't know what they are. You can plug in a transistor. It'll tell you NPN, PNP, BJT, MOSFET, etc. If you plug in a diode, it'll tell you what its voltages, forward and reverse voltages are. I also have a little LC meter. The link I linked to is like $25. I think there are some you can find cheaper. Same sort of thing. You just plug in a component and it gives you a reading. And then I also have a little $17 frequency counter that's good to about 500 megahertz. And all of these are just little tiny things about the size of a deck of cards, and they run off of a 9-volt battery or a USB connector.
So here's something that would be really handy in this vein of RF low-cost test equipment. If you take a frequency counter like the one you just talked about and a dummy load and make yourself a little attenuator tap with a couple of resistors and tap off the RF energy to take it to the frequency counter so it's attenuated so you don't blow up the frequency counter, you could use that to test your transmitter. So not only could you look at the power output if you put a watt meter in line to your load, but also you can use the frequency counter to tell you if your transmitter is on frequency or not. So you could start to use some of these things in conjunction with each other to make a really useful, very inexpensive benchtop, almost like a baby service monitor. Because if you think about it, like a service monitor, like a professional piece of test equipment, like an IFR or a Agilent piece of equipment for, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, it's essentially a signal generator that you could modulate, and a receiver and a scope and a watt meter and a dummy load. And so a lot of those basic things you can kind of cobble together for not a whole lot of money for a basic PAM bench. So does that kind of cover all the test equipment topics?
I've got a few other things. So I'm going to jump into the digital domain of things for a minute here, and then back to analog for a couple other. So logic analyzers are nifty when you're testing any kind of digital communication between components. Hook it up and you'll see, you know, logic high, logic low pulses coming out. They come in a variety of pricing. One that I like is this little 24 megahertz USB connected device from a company called Hobby Components. And all it is basically 8 GPIOs plugged into the end of a Cypress FX2 USB chip. And so all it does is it streams the state of those GPIOs out to the host computer. And it is designed to work with an open source program called SigRock, which has a component called PulseView that displays the signals you're receiving, and also has this huge list of protocol decoders. So pretty much no matter what you hook this thing to, you can break those highs and lows down into, you know, hex data or ASCII data or whatever is being transmitted across that link. If you want to go a bit higher quality than that, if you're looking at higher speed signals or you want to do a little bit more mixed domain stuff, there's the Analog Discovery, which was mentioned before, that does both digital and analog together. There's also a company called Salier that does really, really nice logic analyzers. And those also stream to a host computer, either USB 2 or 3. I think the faster ones require 3. And those range in price from $110 to $600, depending on how many channels and sample speed.
And bandwidth.
They have their own software, which is really nicely put together, a nice and clean interface. So if you want to jump up more into doing digital stuff, those are nice to save up for. And then back to the analog domain, I don't remember where I heard this this saying, but any fast enough digital is just analog again. So as you look at digital signals, you want to look at rise time and ringing on your signals, things like that. So you want a good scope. Depending on what you're doing, you can get by just fine with a used like 20 megahertz analog scope, which is where I got my start. And you can pick those up anywhere from 20 to 50 bucks at a swap meet or off eBay. And then kind of the current standard that I've seen for the quote low cost scopes is the Rigol DS1054Z. It's a 4-channel 50 megahertz scope for $400. And there may be some places where you could put in a serial number in a JavaScript app and it tells you some things to do that make your scope a lot more powerful. But I wouldn't know anything about that.
I got to tell you a little side story.
Okay.
I was at a trade show and I talked to the guy in the Rigol booth and I said, I got one of your scopes and I understand you could put in a code and double the bandwidth. And he just smiled. And I said, I'm just curious. Did you guys do that like on purpose? I mean, obviously the code was on purpose, but the fact that you don't seem to care that people do this, is this like a marketing thing or what? And the guy just laughed. And essentially what he wound up saying was any company that's going to buy the oscilloscope to use in a real commercial setting is not going to hack it. and that's fine. And if they want the higher speed scope, they'll buy the higher speed scope. And if a hobbyist wants to hack it, we really don't care. and I told him, I said, that is an awesome attitude to have. So,
and the more hobbyists that get their hands on them and make use of them at home, if they start getting into a professional setting,
yep,
then that's the name that they're going to remember. Oh, I've got this at home. I'm familiar with it. I like it, et cetera. And exactly, they're going to generate more purchases.
That's why I said, was this really like a marketing thing? And the guys, he didn't say yes or no, but anyway, it was sort of funny because it was very much like, yeah, of course we know all about that. And frankly, we don't really care. Now, maybe the Rigel guy's listening to this podcast and he's like, oh, we really care. But at least at the time.
Yeah. Even without any of the modifications that I may or may not know anything about, it's still a good scope.
Yeah, even at 50 megahertz, it's an amazing scope.
Well, the funny thing is for me, I don't think I've ever used my oscilloscope higher than 10 megahertz, so it kind of doesn't really matter, but it's more the thought.
Yep.
That you could do that.
And, you know, on that note, it's interesting because Siglent this year, which is, I would say, one of Rigel's like chief competitors, rather than fooling around with the, oh, I can firmware unlock it, they just released a 200 megahertz two-channel scope for under $400. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. I need to look more at that one. I think that one is a digital phosphor scope. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That sounds so right.
My understanding is the difference between a digital storage scope and a digital phosphor scope is where the processor lives in the signal chain. So I think the DPOs end up with, it's like a circular memory buffer that feeds pretty much straight into the display. And then the processor can also copy off of that in order to run its math and calculations. Whereas the digital storage scope feeds the data to the processor, which shoves it into memory and then works on it there with that just that snapshot. I am probably completely wrong, but they do work differently, and they do they are useful for a little bit different things, I think. So
for those of you who know what Nick got wrong, he is Exploding Lemur on Twitter at @ExplodingLemur.
Yes, feel free to rant at me. I am happy to take criticism.
Oh, trust me, he's good at giving it out too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that, and we should link in the Siglent one too, because I'm sure that's also a good scope.
I am doing it now.
Cool. Yeah, so if you need higher bandwidth but fewer channels, or slightly lower bandwidth but more channels, there you've got options. And then I have one more thing in the analog domain where I have two items with probably the biggest price disparity between the bottom and top end of what I've got, which is, as I think, Jeremy, you mentioned that Barrick was looking into doing spectrum analyzer stuff with an SDR. So basically, if you take a noise source and a directional coupler and an SDR, either, you know, just the $20 dongles or an AirSpy or whatnot, you can perform analysis of antennas or other resonant systems. If you take out the directional coupler and just run the noise source through a device, like a filter or something, into the SDR, you can characterize the device. Since you're using a wideband noise source, you've run into some interesting resonance issues at times. So it's not spot on with your results, but it's good enough. If you jump up to the other side, Siglent released this past year a really nice spectrum analyzer. It's the SSA3021X. Which is 9 kilohertz to 2.1 gigahertz, but it is $1,600.
With the tracking generator or just a straight?
Right now, I think the testequipment.net or tequipment.net, the company that sells them in the US, they have a deal that the tracking generator is included. So $1,600 is with the tracking generator. And what that, so a tracking generator is an RF output that tracks along with the VFO of the input of the device. So as it does its sweep, it's outputting a signal at the sweep frequency. And that's how you get your test of an antenna or a filter or whatnot. And then since you're just outputting just the single frequency instead of a broadband noise source, you get a better, cleaner result out of that. But anyway, yeah, it's a nice device. I confess I do have one on my bench.
With a tracking generator?
Yes.
How do you like it?
I like it. I also confess I am still not entirely sure that I'm using it right. But I've been using it to help me make a 1.9 gigahertz dipole antenna. And I'm learning that I am awful at making 1.9 gigahertz dipole antennas.
Well, that's a fair bit of test equipment, actually. I think if the listener gets one of everything we mentioned, I think they'd be in pretty good shape.
Still not as expensive as an airplane.
Exactly. Rod, did we get your comment in there on test equipment?
I've realized that I might have simpler needs. I was going to make a comment about, you know, most of the time I'm chucking a rugged multimeter into the bob in the bag, partially for superstitious reasons and partially for when I'm really scratching my head when things are going horribly wrong. At least it's something in the field that I can somewhat rely on.
So what's your pick?
Probably I would have said almost any Fluke multimeter, just because while they're a little expensive, they work. And I don't know how many times I've dropped them and they last forever. And sometimes I just, you know, you give them away or lose them or whatever, but they almost never break.
Okay. So here's a question for you, which is, you could go out and buy a nice looking multimeter for $25, or you could buy a Fluke for $150. How do you justify the difference in the price?
I break the other ones. I keep breaking them. And I guess it's just a comfort thing. I prefer to get something that's a little bit better quality that I know is going to work and I'm going to have higher confidence in. And I know maybe that's a little silly because the type of tolerances that we look at, it doesn't matter. But it's the sort of thing that when I buy a wrench, I tend to buy a better quality wrench and I keep it for a long time. And I think it's the same thing with a multimeter. You just hold on to these things.
So it really is the robustness of the build quality and the parts and the assembly and all that that makes a difference.
It's silly things, how the switch feels, how the, you know, everything just feels like I'm not going to have to replace it next year.
Yep. So I think that's really a consideration for a lot of these things. When you go into it with your eyes open, like, is this something that I want to make sure is really reliable and really works all the time? Or am I willing to give that up for something that could work perfectly fine for years or may not?
Yeah. And I'm not kidding myself either. I'm not buying the $800 version of this.
I went onto eBay to go look for benchtop meters, and I just literally searched for benchtop multimeter. And they tend to range in price from, you know, thousands of dollars down to one that's about $30. And the one that's $30 is the GW Instek, Instek digital multimeter. And it looks very similar to the one that I got at the flea market for $20. I'm kind of looking at the shelf. The one that I have is an LCD. It is not backlit. And most of the ones that you can get on eBay now are LEDs. So they, you know, with the glowing red digits on the display. But other than that, it's the same physical construction of the meter that I have. I would recommend this without hesitation for $30. It is a cheap multimeter. It is a plastic case. It is not rugged. I have no idea how accurate or precise it is, but for $30 to have one that stays on your workbench, you're not going to be putting it into your tool bag and trundling it with you to field day, or at least that's kind of the reason why I bought it, so that I wouldn't have to do that. So I'm not too worried about how resilient it is. And for $30, just to have one at your bench all the time is highly recommended.
By the way, one thing that I do with some of the instruments on my bench, like a voltmeter like that, that doesn't leave the bench, and my variable voltage test power supply, I realized after a while that I would always have multiple black cords with alligator clips. And at the project, there'd be like six alligator clips all clipped together. And so it dawned on me one day that everything that I do has a common ground. So I actually connect my power supply ground to my voltmeter ground, and sometimes some other stuff. And in that way, I don't have to run a bunch of cables to the device under test. So if you do leave your stuff on the bench, you could do stuff like that, where you wire it up once and kind of leave it there.
I was just going to say, with those $30 GW Enstec ones, keep in mind it is just a 3.5-digit multimeter, so it is not going to get you very much precision at all. So it'll probably tell you the difference between 12.5 and 12.6 volts. If that's enough, that's fine. But it's not going to tell you any more than that.
So I went and looked at mine. It is a GDM8034. And I am searching for that on eBay. And they are more expensive than that one. Like new, they're almost $200. There's one for $185. I'm trying to figure out how it's different than the other. Oh, mine's got a capacitance meter. The $31 one does not have a capacitance meter.
Yeah, if you can find like a used HP or Keithley that's somewhat recent on its calibration, that would probably be a good deal. I think I've seen those in the like $120 to $150 range. But those are definitely nice, solid instruments that'll probably last you a good long while. And they're pretty accurate and precise.
Yeah, George, I like your idea of tying your grounds together so that you don't have to run a ground lead from your multimeter to your device under test. That's a great idea.
Yeah, it was just so funny that I realized one day after like 30 years of doing that what's the point of doing that? So I have a little metal plate that's screwed to the shelf that's sitting right on the bench. And it's got a pair of banana jacks, and I run the grounds behind the scenes between the power supply and the voltmeter and all that, and with one lead coming to that socket. So everything is just pulled to one point.
Wow.
So that worked out really well.
I think at this point, let's bring it home and move to what is usually my favorite segment, which is stocking stuffers. So stocking stuffers are going to be anything workbench related at $100 or less.
Well, I could start with a cheapie, $20. So back on the Field Radio podcast, John talked about these Vago levered wire nuts. I love these things, and I've been using them for years. And so I wanted to use that idea here on the podcast and mention that again. So the new version of these things are the model 221s, and you can get them in packs of a few or a dozen of each size, or as many as like 50 of each size. And for about $20, you can get a nice assortment off eBay. And these little things are plastic housings that have little levers on them and a little opening at one end. And you take your wire, you strip it off, you stick the stripped wire into the hole, and then you clip the little lever down, and there's a metal bus bar inside the connector that bridges as many of these wires that you clip in there. And they come in 2, 3, and 5 connector versions. This is one of those things, like we talked about the consumable USB cable. You look at this thing and think, I'm never going to use like 20 of these things, but I guarantee you, you'll go through these things. And I use them for like building up my Go kit to connect all the DC connections together inside the Go box, rather than what I usually do, which is like strip the wires, twist them together, solder them, wrap it all in tape and all that mess. I just strip off the wires, stick them in the wire nuts, clip them down, and they're done. The nice thing about that too is if you ever want to change it, like, oh, I need to add a fourth wire. Well, you just unsnap the levers, pull off the 3 connector version, pop on the 5 connector version, and now you have 2 more connection points. And it's just that quick and easy. But they make for a great, great thing to throw in your Go kit, because when you're in the field, what's one of the most likely problems you're going to have? You're going to have wires that need to get spliced together. maybe 12 volts DC, maybe your antenna wire. Something is going to snap and you're going to need to strip it and hook them together. And this is a whole lot better than just twisting and taping them together and hoping for the best.
So just to add to that, George, one of the things I noticed in my robotics adventures of the last couple of weeks, the power distribution unit that the high school teams use for this first robotics, they're based on those connectors. They're same ones connected to the fuse boxes, which is really neat. And it shows how rugged they are because these things are crashing against each other. It's a fantastic system.
And originally they were made as a replacement for AC wiring wire nuts. So they're made to be pretty durable. And if you really want to see how durable they are, go on YouTube. And there's YouTube videos of people hooking them up into an AC circuit and then running a high amount of current through them. So you can see at what point do the connectors fail. And mostly the wire flames up before the nut fails. So you can see the destructive testing on YouTube.
I like the, I didn't realize that they were this cheap. For some reason, I thought they were more expensive than that. The link that you put in the show notes is $20 for this assortment pack.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It's one of those things too, by the way, if you have a family member who's not a ham, but does any kind of tinkering or electrical stuff, this is a great present for anybody.
I am adding this to my wish list because I think this is a literal good stocking stuffer for my family and my in-laws who never know what to get me.
This qualifies as a great stocking stuffer because if somebody gave you a box of these things, you'd think, well, that's great. If somebody gave you another box of them, you would think that's even better.
Yep, exactly.
You know, and you might not buy another box for yourself. So you can never have too many of these things.
So speaking of splicing things together, I'm going to give my favorite present that my wife's got me in the last couple of years, which is a Leatherman squirt. So,
yes.
Except this is the electrician edition. So you'll see it's called the ES4. Now, these things don't cost that much, especially for a Leatherman. I think it's $32 when I looked it up. They're tiny. They're minuscule. You can carry it every day. But there's wonderful, wonderful wire strippers in place of where the pliers would be. All the way down to, and I'm trying to remember, George, how fine the wires are on it, but they're very fine wire strippers.
Down to 26 gauge because I use it for some Pactena wire stripping.
I use this thing all the time, and I'm mildly worried because sometimes in the last 2 weeks it's gone missing. So I'll have to go get another one because I can't live without this thing.
Oh, so darn.
I got to tell you guys, this is the thing when Rod and I were sending an email back and forth on our soda kits. We both had this like oddball Leatherman tool that I've never seen anybody else use. And I thought, oh man, we're like separated at birth, picking this odd tool. This is the thing I take with me for any kind of soda outing because it's so small and lightweight and so handy. Actually, this thing and some of those wire clips is like the perfect combination.
It's all you need.
Yeah. I've been a Leatherman Wave guy myself. The Wave is the one that I have always enjoyed the most. I've had several different models over the years, usually whatever was Costco was selling the year that I lost the previous one kind of thing. But the Wave is the one that I keep going back to.
So the Wave is kind of like the traditional full-size Leatherman,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. And this little ES4 that Rod's talking about, that's like miniature. Little
tiny one. Yeah.
Yeah. Very different kind of an animal.
Yeah, but the squirt is a little tiny one. You can just kind of slip in your pocket. That's nice.
Yep, very handy.
So Smitty, what's your stocking stuffer?
So growing up, my family always gave consumables in stockings.
Chocolate,
nuts, batteries are a big one. Batteries are the thing that whenever I got batteries in my stocking, I knew I was going to have a gift that took batteries.
So right? That's kind of a cop out, isn't it?
for me or for my family?
Not at
for
all.
The family.
No.
Okay.
Not at all.
Not all of us grew up in houses where we use San Pellegrino for bathwater.
And it's better than not getting batteries at all.
Well, that's true.
That's right. Yeah. And it was always the kind of the tease, if you will, because, right, you know, kids always wake up before their family does on Christmas, or at least I always did, you know. So what kind of stocking stuffers? Consumables are always good. We've talked about a lot of them. Microcontrollers. There are a lot of dirt cheap microcontrollers out there. ESP8266s, you can get them for a couple of bucks each when you buy them 10 at a time. That kind of thing. And these are little microcontrollers that you can put into a project and leave it there. It's not the kind of thing that you invest in a big one that you use for a project and then you take it apart and you use for a different project and take it apart, so on and so forth. So if you buy a lot of these little micros for super cheap, they're cheap enough that you can put it in a project and leave it there.
Hey, that reminds me, I have a suggestion. Along those lines, I didn't even think about. We talked about the microbit a while back. Yeah. And if you have any people that you want to give a stocking stuffer to who are not necessarily hams, and they're not necessarily like into the whole Arduino Raspberry Pi thing yet, the microbit's a great way to start because it's a really simple thing to program.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I am particularly partial to the ESP8266s these days, just because a lot of the projects that I've been working on, I kind of landed on them for various reasons, and I've been pretty happy with the architecture. They're amazingly powerful for what they are. But any microcontroller, well, I mean, pick the one that the person you're giving it to enjoys, but chances are they've got some pretty reasonably priced ones as well. If you are looking for something a little bit bigger, I like kits. For me, if you found a kit, something that was designed by somebody else that I get to assemble, and then I read the instructions and I'm looking at the circuit diagram and I am learning from the thing as I am building it, to me, that's kind of the perfect gift. Even if it's not something that I'm likely to use when I'm done with it, if it is a skill set or a knowledge that I will be able to use, or even is just interesting, right? Then that's kind of the perfect stocking stuffer to me. So the kind of things that we're talking about, thank you, Nick. Sorry, he just sent an IM. That is, I'm going to give Smitty a sack of DIP 40 8051s for Christmas. Thank you, Nick. Because, you know, the 80s called and they want their microcontroller back. But the kits. So of course, I've already talked about the BitX 40. I've been on the show a couple of times talking about the BitX 40, and I haven't forgotten about it. My life has just gotten a little crazy lately, and I've put that project on hold. But I also recently picked up a QRP Labs QCX, which is a little 5-watt QRP CW only rig. But it's a very unique design. It's kind of SDR, but kind of not. I mean, it's analog, but it's doing like quadrature decoding. It's a very interesting design. I don't want to take time to try and explain it now, and I'd get it wrong anyway. But it's a really neat kit, and it's $50, I believe. So they're relatively inexpensive. And when you're done assembling this thing, you have a great standalone radio. And while you're going through it and assembling it, you're reading the instructions and learning from it, right? So they're not that expensive, and they're fun to build, and you get a thing that's usable when you're done with it, and you've learned along the way. I mean, to me, that's like the best gift ever.
I would add, by the way, around the holiday season, a lot of times families are together and you're looking for something to do. So I think your idea of the kit is not only good for the person who would get the kit and want the thing once it's built, but could also be just a really fun thing for maybe a couple people to work on to build it together, just to get that experience of building something and having something to do, rather than just like sit around and, you know, hang out with the family. What's better than building a kit with one of your relatives or friends while that's over for Christmas, right? So any kind of like physical kit building sort of activity could be just a great thing to do.
Kind of on that subject, several years ago, I built a couple of the ubiquitous tape measure 3-element 2-meter Yagis that are great for tea hunts. My daughter and I put those together on a weekend, and we had a great time building those. We haven't actually had a chance to go do a tea hunt with them yet. It's been several years, and I feel really bad about that. But we had a great time building those together, and those were, you know, maybe $20 worth of parts from the hardware each. And it's Yeah, it was a blast.
So you need to go get yourself the Elecraft XG3 SigGen so you can use that for your own T-Hunt transmitter.
A different show. We'll talk about that some other time. Okay. Nick, what are your stocking stuffers?
So I actually think that little $14 logic analyzer from Hobby Components. Is that the company? Anyway, I think that'd make a pretty cool stocking stuffer. Toss one or even two in there, one for the bench, one for the backpack. I also like breadboards. Breadboards are always useful. And there are these nifty little power supplies that you can pop onto a breadboard that line up with the breadboard power rails. And you just plug in like a 9 to 12 volt DC wallboard, and you can set them to 5 volt or 3.3 volt out. And those are pretty handy, and you can get those just single, or you can get them in like 5 or 10 packs. And they're pretty cheap.
I saw one of those things on maybe on eBay somewhere, and I thought, wow, that's actually a brilliant idea. I never even thought of that.
Yeah, I've got a couple, and they're useful.
They are useful. I've actually had to make my own for when I was doing some audio work. I wanted a positive and negative 12 volt supply. And so I made one of those that had, positive on one side and negative on the other side of the breadboard for doing my audio work.
And then one more thing that I have that I guess is actually a consumable, because I can never have enough of these, are jumper wires. yes. So I get them by the like 40 wire strip of assortments of female, 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 male, and male, male. And I just peel off whatever I need. If I wreck any, oh well, I have more. And I just keep a couple of those sets in a box. And they're great to have around.
Are you talking about the little header pin jumper?
Yeah, it's just like a 6-inch wire with the header pins, either male or female, on the ends.
And those are getting pretty cheap.
Yeah, like the set I got had 40 each of male, 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 female, 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 and that was like less than $10.
Yeah, I'll plus one that as a gift idea. That's a great idea.
Let's see, Rod, anything else on your list?
Yeah, I'm going to add one more thing on there, which is only because the last week or so I've been out to two different makerspaces out in the Toronto area here. And it just occurred to me as I was writing this up that, wow, what a great gift certificate to a month or two membership within a makerspace. Not hard to find. And of course, you want to go check them out yourself to make sure that, you know, they're viable and useful. But I was to one today that blew my mind. These guys have done a really great job. And I could see all sorts of different types of people coming into this space and saying, not just hams, and it's not just electronics. It's making furniture. It's making all sorts of good stuff. And what a good time.
Yeah, I'll plus one that one, too.
Yeah, people working on all kinds of interesting things from mechanical stuff, electronic stuff, woodworking, metalworking, crafts of the fiber arts or materials engineering, as I've heard it referred to, of creating garments and so forth. There's just so many creative people there working on so many interesting things.
For me, those kinds of things are more about community than about the tools themselves. I mean, the tools are handy as well, but it's really, it's a place to go when you want to go hang out with other creative types, whether they are doing electronic making or fiber engineering, which is what I refer to my wife's hobbies as. and I stand by it, man. We kind of got into a big Twitter conversation about this recently. She is doing just as much engineering, problem solving, creative, using tools and techniques to build a thing with her needles and fiber and yarn as I do with my soldering iron and resistors and transistors and everything. And there is no difference between those two hobbies except for the medium.
I thought you were going to say that she's using a bunch of EL wire.
No. She's doing straight up fiber. But it is listening to her talk about the patterns and the techniques they use for making all of the weird shapes, like an armpit, right? Armpits are hard. That is a very interesting surface to try and model. And if you're going to try and do that out of a single knitted garment, I mean, that's some engineering going into that. And trying to do that and keeping it artistic and all kinds. I mean, I'm a knitter groupie is kind of the way I like to put it. But anyway, I will defend that is just as much making as anything else. In fact, they've been around for tens of thousands of years longer than we have with our electronics.
Yes.
Agreed.
I guess I'm left.
How about you then?
Yeah. So this continues to be and will be until something better comes out. Mentioned it before, but for $99, an AirSpy Mini SDR receiver, 24 megahertz to 1.6 gigahertz, up to 6 megahertz of usable, ends up being 4.8, 6 megahertz aliased bandwidth, 4.8 megahertz usable, which of course is enough to see all of 2 meters at the same time. The hobby of looking for signals is something that I've picked up this year and have really enjoyed. And with all the software that has been developed, the SDR Sharp, which of course is a Windows application, but GQRX on Linux and Mac support the AirSpy natively. I think SDR Console does as well. But with the advent of Spy Server, which is a little application that allows you to put these things online remotely, so you can connect over a network to them. They can run off of a Windows PC, a Linux box, or even a 32-bit sufficiently powerful single-board computer, like an Odroid or a Tinkerboard. But that is that's a top choice as far as a cool gift to get somebody something that they may not have that unlocks other aspects of the hobby. Now, also number two, I mentioned these before as well, but the Acromill storage bins I think are indispensable. They're available for $30 or less. I think they won't fit in a stocking, but all of us, and I don't care who you are, unless maybe you're George. All of us has to can always use more organization.
Even I can.
I don't know. If you were any more,
I'm not sure where you'd fit it.
If you were any more organized, there'd be nothing on your workbench.
I feel like so odd because the workbench was clean for a change.
Yeah. Well,
I think putting RFID stickers on every single one of your tools was probably a little over the top.
Do you think so? I don't know.
Maybe.
What's sad is I'm pretty sure you're not kidding.
But he can now locate them within three-dimensional space to a precision of down to a centimeter.
Half a centimeter, but yeah.
Oh, you've improved it.
Well, yeah.
But it makes sure that he gets the wrench back at field day.
Yes, that's right. Well, folks, I want to sincerely thank our guests, Smitty, Nick, and Rod, for joining us again on the Workbench. Your insights and ability to help folks spend their money knows no equal, and we appreciate you taking the time.
When it comes to spending somebody else's money, I'm just getting started.
All right, so if anybody wants to connect with our guests online, Smitty, where would they go?
Twitter, I am at Smitty Halibut, SmittyHalibut.
All right, Nick?
Also on Twitter, I am at Exploding Lemur, all one word, ExploDingLemur. I also have a GitHub repository under the same. I don't have too much there, but you can go poke around. Yeah.
And Rod?
No colorful name, just my call sign, at VA3ON.
All right, and we will make sure that they put their contact information, any links, because, for instance, Smitty, you have a pretty active YouTube channel, but we will make sure all of that is in the show notes, along with links to pretty much everything we've talked about. Again, sincerely want to thank folks for coming along with us on this 2017 edition of our annual holiday shopping show. In the meantime, if you have feedback for us, ideas for the show, want to correct anything that we've said, or have other constructive feedback, please feel free to send us emails to workbench@hamradio360.com. This is Jeremy, KF7IJZ. You can follow me on Twitter at KF7IJZ.
And I'm George, KJ6View, and you can follow me on Twitter at KJ6View.
One final thing before we leave, I want to remind all of our listeners that PowerFilm Solar has been kind enough to continue to offer our listeners a 10% discount off of their 30-watt solar panel and power pole adapter package. More information available at www.powerfilmsolar.com/products/workbench for all the information on that.
And next week, we have a special guest.
Oh, do tell.
Next week is going to be David Schoaf from Elecraft to come on and talk about RF power amplifiers.
You know what's special about this, don't you?
What's that?
That we are actually one episode ahead.
Shh, don't tell. And don't get used to it.
Don't get used to it. Folks, good luck spending your money. May Santa bring you all of the things for your workbench that you desire. 73 and take care.
73s.
Where's the Be Good Humans?
I always say that. I do, but I always feel bad because it feels like I get in the way of your guys' dynamic. So
we have a dynamic. Oh, okay.
All right, so you just want a standalone Be Good Humans and you'll glue it on at the end?
Sure.
Sure.
All right. Be Good Humans, everyone.
Is it Be Good Humans or Be Good Humans?
Be or, Good Humans. No, Good Humans is in parentheses.
It's a cookbook.
It's a cookbook.
Okay.
All right. Excellent. I'm sure there's a good usable 6 minutes out of that.